if I were an old curmudgeon,
thank you.
They really would soften you up.
Oh, well,
I get it. We should take all that into consideration. You know, even the organic guy, I didn't know. I don't think they're defaced out of it. There's some things they can do, but mitigation plans.
There's less traffic in the 60s.
He left our school.
You know what this is? Yeah.
I thought it was a dirt road.
Yeah, it is the Enbridge pipeline.
Well, gated when we were
okay.
High school. I think I'll invite them. And then a group of us, Malcolm.
Did it work?
Actually, Yvonne. Do I like smart? Problem taken care of, I think.
Got a bunch of engine blocks.
Only grocery store in Moose Lake.
Got chains.
Apparently, the guys went up and said, sorry, you can't keep any of this. You have to throw it all out. So there's like five dumpsters that we're throwing food into, or will be soon. It's got a little soot on it. There's an electrical fire. Consequently, she wants to know if they can't give it away to food shows.
They don't have case mounts.
We won't. Apparently, we won't let them.
But there used to be a public gate house.
Good afternoon. I'd like to call the meeting to order to our sparse crowd. Must be not much on the agenda today. I thought Todd being here to present, I thought the whole place would be full, but not so much. I expect more out of you. I want to also welcome Katie Clark-Sieben. Commissioner Clark-Sieben, I told you're on the phone.
I am. Hello.
Very
Thank
good.
You.
Nice to hear your voice again. We've kind of forgotten what you look like, so maybe you could text a picture.
Well, what I look like has changed.
I guess so. Yeah, that's true. Good to hear your voice, and thank you for taking the time to participate today. Our first item on the agenda is the adoption of our consent agenda, which you should have in front of us. It is there for your
move approval,
your reading and approval or disapproval.
Move approval, Mr. Chair.
There is
Mr.
a motion to approve, and there is a second. Is there discussion on the motion? If hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. Let us go then to the November minutes of our November meeting, which was relatively short. It's just a couple of pages. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of the November meeting?
So moved.
There is. Is there a second?
Second.
There is. Is there discussion on the minutes of the November 19th meeting? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The motion carries. So let's have introductions. Start with John.
John Saxhog. I'm a citizen member from
the city. Kristen Idy Tollison, citizen member from Southeast Minnesota.
Brian Napstad, Balzer chairman.
John Linkstein. I'm the commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Tom Landwehr, commissioner of DNR.
Kate Knuth, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
I'm Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation.
Eric Tomlinson, citizen member from the Twin Cities.
Dave Fredrickson, Commissioner of Agriculture.
Will Soifer, Environmental College Board.
Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health.
Julie Gehring, citizen member from Moorhead.
Mike Rothman, Commerce Commissioner.
Sandy Romo, representing Met Council.
Thank you, one and all. The chair's report, again, is going to be brief. I had to cram. I got home late last night from Washington, D.C., having spent a couple of days out there on another issue. I picked up the agenda on the way to work this morning, and so my report to you is simply that. What I want to do is go directly to Will and Will's executive director report. I will say we did have an excellent meeting this morning, sponsored by or encouraged by Executive Director Will Soifert to listen to citizens' concern regarding the Enbridge pipeline. And so we spent a couple of hours, thanks to John Linkstein and the loan of the Commissioner's Conference Room, to hear concerns from a variety of folks, and that was eye-opening for me, and I suspect for the other commissioners, Commissioner Rothman, Commissioner Linkstein, and Commissioner Landwehr, to be able to hear that discussion and understand the impact of the proposed pipeline on those folks. So with that, Will, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to use my time and my executive director report this afternoon to give you a little primer on our budget. I want to accomplish two things with you this afternoon. First is give you just a general overview about our budget picture, what it looks like, how it works, and also number two is I want to get some feedback from you all on prioritization as we move forward through the rest of this fiscal year and plan for the next biennium. You know, up to date, this work that we've been working on most of this year has really been informed by your recommendations from the Governor's Institute on Community Design, from statute, and from Executive Order 1132 and the reports that came from that. But my plan going forward is to make this an annual exercise, you know, in fulfillment of our requirements in Minnesota Statutes 116C03, which establishes our relationship with the MPCA and how we get staff support, and how we also get staff support from our member agencies. So I will get I will cover that here in a little bit, but before we move into the budget picture, I just want to remind everyone what we've been working on throughout the course of this biennium. And if you look in front of you, you should have a one pager on silica sand that we created to represent some of this there. You know, the first item on our slide here is the tools to assist local governments. You're all familiar with this. This was an assignment that came from the 2013 legislature. We completed it in March of this year when the document was approved in Rochester, but it was followed by months of interagency work, probably about a half dozen public meetings in southern Minnesota and the Minnesota River Valley, pretty extensive public outreach, and it's been utilized quite a bit since it has been approved. Robust technical assistance efforts. This is the technical assistance team that was created and funded by the 2013 legislature. You received a presentation at our last board meeting on the recommendations that we submitted to the city of Wabasha as they updated their ordinance. But we've received a number of informal requests on a variety of silica sand related topics, including air monitoring, environmental review, road maintenance agreements, etc. And these have all been supported by staff in your agencies that are funded by the silica sand appropriation. We have our environmental review rulemaking that's currently underway for silica sand. We've been working with a panel throughout the year. It is our plan to bring a preliminary rule to the board for approval at our next meeting in January. That will begin the formal rulemaking process. To this point, we've been in rule and sonar development, working extensively with a panel and with our partner agencies, the PCA and the DNR, as they've been doing their rulemaking throughout the course of the year. The ordinance library was another component of our silica sand work. You saw a mock-up from Heather at our last meeting. This is scheduled to be integrated into our website with some work that we're going to be partnering with a web developer later this month and into next month. And then finally, I just wanted to point out there's been some pretty extensive outreach on silica sand issues throughout the course of the year. Numerous surveys, meetings, town hall forums, meetings with industry representatives, citizen groups, facility tours, staff presentations at local government units. We've been very active and think we've gotten a good product from that level of public engagement. So that's the high-level silica sand work, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of our other work, but at any point, too, during this presentation, please feel free to interject any comments or questions if you have any. This is the body of work largely that's been funded through our operational budget. I think you're all familiar with this report, Minnesota and Climate Change. This was approved in August up in Duluth. This has been distributed quite widely. We've done a number of print runs, and some of our partners have done a number of print runs too, to really get this report distributed throughout the state. We hope to continue that. We are also working with the same company that assisted us in the development of the report on the creation of a web-based version of the report. So we will have a website that will be live featuring all the content in this report sometime in the next 2 months. So stay tuned, and we'll share that with you as it's completed. Climate solutions and economic opportunities. You heard the preliminary report last month. Since then, we had a stakeholder kickoff session at the Science Museum and a number of stakeholder meetings this week that have been highly attended, upwards of 100 people at each meeting, where there's been great discussion across stakeholders on how the implementation for some of these policies. And Anna will have some time later in our meeting to provide a presentation, a little bit deeper dive on some of that work, and hope to answer any questions that you might have lingering from our last meeting. The NGA Clean Energy and Economic Development Project, this was another project that we supported with the leadership of Deed and Commerce. You all heard the presentation of the final report last month, but we are pleased with this partnership and look forward to continuing to work with these agencies on these issues going forward. The next item is the Interagency Pipeline Coordination Team. This is an effort that really began back in August with the support of 10 agencies looking at the various issues and impacts associated with the potential construction of infrastructure to move oil across our state over the upcoming years. And we've been meeting regularly with this interagency group on a weekly basis to have a dialogue about the various issues, and also to begin preparing a report that we'll bring to the board. We're planning for February to start to really digest these issues and think about how the state is addressing them. The Energy and Environment 2015 report card, this is really a follow-up to the 2012 report card that was mandated by Executive Order 1132. We've worked with member agencies to update the data and the graphs that were contained in that 2012 report, and we'll be walking through those with you all and discussing best ways that we can communicate this going forward and the value of doing this at the board level. And then finally, environment review, technical assistance and guidance documents. Since last July, we've updated our EAW guidelines, the EAW form, and have also updated the citizens guide in an effort to incorporate some plain language. So it's been a pretty busy couple of years, and now I want to give you a sense of how all this work has been supported with our current funds. This is the first of two budget slides. If you see there, the blue is, well, first off, before I dive into each wedge here, our overall budget picture is $500,000 per year. That comes out of both of the general fund. About two-thirds comes from the general fund, and one-third comes from the environmental fund. This is permanent funding level, and as you can see here, about two-thirds of this is payroll and funds the majority of the board's staffing. 19% of this is assessed by the MPCA for administrative support, and this relationship is outlined in statute as part of the 2011 move of EQB staff from admin to this building. We have a service level agreement with the agency, and it provides the following: rent, fiscal services, contracting, continuous improvement, business support, human resources, data services, and communication services. On a high level, this assessment provides an efficiency to EQB and gives us access to services we would otherwise have to procure on an as-needed basis. 3% of our budget is for Minute technology services. This is all the services associated with Minute, but does not cover website development and maintenance. We'll get to that in a little bit. And 7% of our budget is dedicated to other operating expenses. And this covers expenses related to travel and training, printing, equipment and space rental, and in this case, website development. Now, currently we have diverted $50,000 to Minute to contract for website development. And so, as you recall, we've worked with Minute Services here at MPCA to migrate our old from our old website to a new content management system and onto the MPCA server. And now we are looking to work with an additional developer to now try and make our website a little bit more functional, a little bit more user-friendly, more updated. And so we will we'll continue to look for guidance from you all, but we're excited to have a developer that I believe will be starting on Monday to start helping us make some of these changes. And some of our priority changes include the ordinance library, include webcasting our meetings, and some of our other higher profile projects. We want to make our web presence a little bit more of a reflection of the work that we've been doing right now. And this, though, however, is a one-time opportunity. We generated some significant salary savings from when the appropriation was available after the 2013 legislature appropriated it and when all staff was hired. So we're able to use these funds on a one-time basis to get a contractor to do some of this work on website development. However, this doesn't address our long-term website needs. So we can come back to that in a little bit. I do want to just let everyone know there is growing pressure on this fund as additional work is requested and done. And you'll see this as we walk through some of our projects. So we will look to you all for guidance in our biennial budget planning process and also as we plan our budget going into next fiscal year, so we can make sure that our work best aligns with your priorities. And this is a picture of our silica sand funds. And there are two funds that make up this pie right here. One is a $500,000 a year permanent budget for silica sand technical assistance and for the creation of the model standards document. The other dollars that are pictured here is a $425,000 one-time investment that pays for the rulemaking for the EQB and for the MPCA. That is available until spent, and then the budget will simply be the technical assistance effort. Roughly one-third of the technical assistance budget supports staff at the DNR and the Department of Health, and so that's the green other state agency expense. And then the blue is that's EQB silica sand dedicated staff, and that is MPCA staff that support silica sand work. As we spend down the rulemaking appropriation, there will be some pressure on the technical assistance fund because implementation of the rules will require technical assistance, and that could potentially change the level and recipient of fund transfer. And so I just want to share that with you all as really the way the pie breaks down is based on where the work is needed and where it's done as we work through these tasks. It's not outlined in statute how we allocate it, just that we have the opportunity to pass through these funds to our member agencies that support that. The one thing to note here, too, is that the largest operating expense is attributable to our work supporting the advisory panel. And so that was via MMB facilitation and the costs associated with that project. But on a high level, we do believe that this program is appropriately resourced, and we won't be seeking any change to this fund. So that gets us to where we are to kind of round out this fiscal year and looking forward to 2016 and 17. So I'm just going to run through some of the projects that we're working on. And at any point, please do share if you have any thoughts about prioritization or questions about these projects. I'm happy to answer them. But this will help us as we develop our own staffing plans to do these projects, what it means and how we move things around. And, you know, the first is our interagency pipeline report that we're working on right now. And before I get into this, I do want to point out that we are really only able to do the things that we've talked about because of the very high level of interagency support and in-kind staff work that you all provide and support. And so I just want to express our appreciation and our gratitude for your continued participation in that, but also for that very high quality work that we're able to receive from your agencies. And that applies for all of these items up here. But the interagency pipeline project is, as I indicated, will be brought to you probably in February with a draft report to begin the discussion on these issues. There are 10 participating agencies, and the one thing I want to point out here, though, is that in terms of EQB staff that was previously supporting environmental review has largely been redirected to complete this project. And so as we prioritize our work, that's one of the trade-offs that we have to make, that we're making currently right now, and we'll have to think about that going forward and how we want to compensate and move things around as the project also ramps down. Item number two is...
I think the term was adequately resourced, Will. I think you used that term, which means finding enough money to pay for it, doesn't it?
Thank you for the translation,
adequately
Mr. Chairman.
I like that.
Yeah, I'll get to that.
Always.
I try to be very diplomatic.
Well, I always try to tease Will with his bureaucratic speech. But what is that? What is adequately resourced in farmer talk? That's a question.
What is it? Adequately resourced?
Got enough money, right?
You got enough money. Yeah.
Cash. All right.
So if I said that, I meant to say we were inadequately resourced.
Yes. I'm sorry to interrupt. I was getting a little dry there for a second.
Well, you want me to do a dance? Yeah. My plan here is to lull you to sleep, and then when I do have an ask, you'll be ready to get rid of me. The Interagency Water Report, though, this is a report that's mandated in Minnesota Statutes 103A.43. This is a five-year report that's meant to be kind of a five-year update of the state water plan. It is a interagency project that is mandated in statute. And, you know, right now we do not have a staff assignment for this project. As we go into the upcoming months, we will either have to compensate by ramping down some of our climate work potentially or impacting some of our pipeline effort, or we might be looking to you all for some level of in-kind support to do this. So I just want to put that out there because that is a mandate that we complete that project. Our CZO work, Anna's going to come up here shortly and talk about CZO, so I'm not going to spend... Yes?
Can I, just on the water report, you know, one of the things as we think about CZO, and just offer this because we're trying to garner, I think one of the things the board has done a lot of effort around is bringing public comment to the board rather than, you know, we've got a little better situation in terms of staffing resources. So maybe as we think about that interagency water report and some of these reports and we think about piggybacking public comment periods and gaining more input for the same outreach. And I don't know if that's practical or possible, but we had a meeting in Duluth, for example, and perhaps there are ways we could, you know, combine some of our time as board members as we think about these reports and engaging citizens and communities around the state. Maybe we can use that move the board around concept and getting public input for some of those purposes, as we talked about this interagency water report and having been through many of them in my career. I don't know that we've always done the best job of asking the people around the state to contribute ideas. So just a thought as we think about all these reports and activities where we, you know, we're trying to gain input and then feed it back to people, we might combine efforts around some of those, and it's just something to think about.
Thanks. For the record, we've been joined by Commissioner Mossman. Thank you for being here, Matt. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It's a good suggestion. And actually, you know, with respect to the water report, we'll take this back to the board for a little bit more discussion, but it is the first one that has been done since prior to passage of the legacy funds, since prior to the creation of the interagency coordination team, and a lot of coordinating efforts and great interagency work has happened since then. And so as we think about what do we want to accomplish with this report, there are a lot of different directions we can go. And so we will look to you for strategic guidance and also some level of staff participation in the project. So silica sand opportunities and needs, as I indicated earlier, the formal rulemaking process will be underway this spring for environmental review. In addition, you know, we're planning to be making updates to the toolkit document at a later date as information is updated and we get better information from our member agencies. We want to make that a living document. In addition, local government requests for support have been steady, and we do anticipate that to continue. With respect to our website, you know, we are contracting, as I mentioned, with Minute for some one-time website development, but just please keep in mind that web development is not part of our assessment from the department, and this is a service gap that is currently unmet, and we are exploring ways to procure resources going forward. And the one thing I want to leave you all with is we're not unique in terms of small boards and commissions. This is a challenge that all of our peer boards and commissions are trying to address currently. Environmental review efficiency. Coming out of the report from the executive order and from the Office of Legislative Auditor, there's a lot of work that remains to be done. We've done some important things. We hope to build off of this work. And one of the items is a web tool that we've talked about with you all that we're seeking some budget support for. But an interim step is our environmental review document conversion. And so we've allocated a small amount of dollars to support a pilot with a third party to do some scanning for us and see how far we can get with that investment to see what the most efficient way is to actually get all these historical documents online so they can be more readily available to the public. Offsite meetings, you know, we've had a number of meetings this year throughout the state. I think the question that I have for you all, and I'm not putting you on the spot here, so don't feel you need to answer this, but if you would like to share, please do, is this a priority that you have and you'd like to continue? There are, there are additional resources that go into and planning that goes into these, and we're happy to do that. We just want to make sure that you're comfortable with us working with you all to continue to try and do periodic meetings outstate. I know Julie's been looking at me to go to Moorhead at some point, but
maybe not that far.
I think we should go in the spring. There's a little diversion project going on that Commissioner Landwehr wants to talk about. So
bring your own canoe.
I got a couple.
Well played.
And then the final bullet here is on the energy and environment report card, and we'll talk to you a little bit more about that. But really the question is about the extent to which you would like this information updated, packaged, and communicated to the public. And, I put the Environmental Congress on the bottom there because I think that was a really successful effort, but a very, very staff-intensive effort. And, really the question is what frequency is this project, would you all like to see this project happen on? And so another thing to think about. And so in closing, I'll go back to there. I look to you for guidance on prioritization. In addition, we're certainly working within the biennial budget process to try and get some funds to do a number of things. One is to address our operational sustainability. That cuts across supporting a number of projects, but that's also website related and everything else that falls under that umbrella. Climate change technical assistance effort. This is an interagency appropriation that we're seeking to support and build off of the work of CZEO. I think we've all been very on the staff level. We've been very very amazed at the high level of interagency participation, and we don't want this to be a one-off climate effort. We want to see this institutionalized and supported going forward. So we'll be seeking resources to try and do that. Environmental conflict resolution, we've worked with the Bureau of Mediation Services to try and develop a pilot project to provide some grant funds to local communities who might be interested in using some different techniques, conflict resolution techniques, to try and address some issues that otherwise get bogged down in environmental review and potentially litigation. The environmental review web tool, this is something we'll continue to seek funds for. And then environmental review efficiency is another topic that we hope to address through our budget requests. And so that's kind of the high level of what we're thinking going into next biennium. But I do welcome any questions or thoughts regarding prioritization.
Any comments or questions regarding budget priorities? John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Will, I just want to chime in on those – of those five bullets, I want to talk about one, the first one on sustaining the operations, and then the review, the web tool, and efficiency on environmental review, which I think could involve some things related to mandatory categories and sort of the thresholds that the world has been living with for a very long time. And You know, if I were to just offer my perspective, I think the timing is right for EQB now that it has some stability in terms of just baseline resources to get some additional efforts around those three items, because those are the bread and butter of work of the board and the people who interact with the board's regulatory responsibilities for EAWs and EISs. And so from my perspective, that rises to the top of sort of making sure that the organization can continue to add value to many customers, because as you know, the local units of government that are responsible governmental units for environmental review don't see an update on those thresholds very often. Should be a priority for this board, I think, to support that kind of review and efficiency of its own operations for the benefit of, you know, the progress that are being made by local units of government around the state to address their own priorities. And so I think that group of three rises up the list from my perspective.
Other comments? Tom?
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, piggybacking on the discussion we had this morning, I think environmental review efficiency is a good way of looking at what's there and might need to be changed, but it might also include what's not there that might need to be changed or added.
Mm-hmm. John.
Mr. Chair, you've really highlighted here the huge number of responsibilities that this board deals with and a lot of challenges. And I think coming up with priorities for those is going to be difficult. I was wondering if there's any type of a formal process that we need to institute to determine those priorities.
Well, that's a good question, and you know, I to some level, John, I leave that to you all to you know, let me know what kind of formal process you expect. I can certainly bring back a more formal budget and work plan if that is what you all would like. I'm happy to do that. I want to defer to you, though, to provide some guidance on that subject.
Brian?
Thank you, John. Mr. Chair. Does that answer your...
Oh, I was just going to throw out... I mean,
go ahead.
In a forum like this, we can throw things left and right.
Yeah.
Unless we have some method of prioritizing, it's not going to work.
Yep. Well, I can bring some back to you, John. Yeah, thank you for the suggestion.
Brian?
Thank you for your question, John, because that was essentially my question, at least the first half of my question is, what is the process? The Association of Minnesota Counties has a new priority that's come up recently, and it has to do with a Class 1 air designation for an area of the state of Minnesota that certainly has potential to affect all of the agencies that sit at this table, as well as many others. The question I would have is, how would that be discussed to determine whether or not that's something that the EQB should be involved with and tracking, or if that remains with a specific agency? That would be a good case in point. From the analysis of AMC, it affects all but 17 counties in the state, so it's certainly got statewide implications. I'm sure PCA would agree it impacts PCA, DNR, MnDOT, health. I mean, I think this potential air quality designation could impact everybody here. So how do we kick that discussion off and make that determination, which I think is what, John, you were asking?
Mm-hmm. I can certainly work with you, Commissioner, to set up a presentation and bring something to the board for discussion on that. I think I hear almost two different questions. One is, how do we bring forward topics for the board to discuss? And the other is, how do we kind of formalize a budget work planning process? And I they're same, you know, they're related, but they're different, because we can take on topics without having a budget impact. You know, we can afford your agency and other agencies the opportunity to bring interagency issues before the board that don't turn into projects that need to be staffed and resourced by the board, or we can bring them forward in a way that do. And you know, there's constant, you know, it is an iterative process, but it is something that we do want to enable. I think any member of our board or anyone in the public, quite frankly, if there are topics you want brought forward to the board, that's our job to work with whoever to make sure that we can do that, and we do it in a way that we can have an you know, informative conversation, and so I'm happy to work with you on that, to schedule bringing that forward to the board. But in terms of a more formalized structure, I can certainly work to make that happen for you. Yeah.
Other comments or questions, Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd just like a little more information on the climate change technical assistance teams. I understand with the silica sand and you know, with rulemaking and local government needing more information. So I'm curious and very interested in that. And then the environmental conflict resolution, I think, would potentially be increasingly important as decision-making happens in different ways and different groups get more involved. And could you just give us a little bit more
sure.
on each of those?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the way that the climate change technical assistance effort has been envisioned is actually modeled almost entirely off of the silica sand technical assistance effort, where there is a $500,000 appropriation from the legislature that that went to the board to support interagency efforts in the agencies that do have the technical expertise. So we manage this effort, but we pass through most of those funds to the agencies that do the work, and it does support, you know, local governments and a variety of other folks who have questions and needs related to silica sand issues. We're trying to construct this almost a clone of that with respect to climate change, to really try and send some funds to the agencies that we rely on so much to support some of the climate work that's currently underway, because we are concerned that, you know, every agency is under a lot of pressure for a lot of, you know, on a lot of different subjects, and we want to try and find some resources that can really institutionalize that work. And so, you know, we've sought input from, you know, partners like Green Step Cities and local governments, and you know, and so I imagine this is something that probably will evolve and as it's discussed, but we wanted to put that concept forward in the biennial budget process in the event that there is some support and we can at least start that dialogue. The way that we look at conflict resolution is really there are a number of conflicts that they get bogged down in litigation or they complicate and can slow down environmental review, and what I think some of the communities maybe really need is third party neutral conflict resolution services. That can be facilitation, that can be alternative dispute resolution, that can be mediation. It can be a lot of different things. And so what we have done is, on a staff level, had a conversation with the Bureau of Mediation Services to try and find a way to partner on an effort that is really tailored to environmental conflicts, whereby if a local unit of government or even a state agency or another partner, there was an environmental conflict that they felt they needed some assistance for, they could work with us and BMS to tailor. The BMS would do an assessment and make a recommendation on what kind of conflict resolution would be appropriate for that community. They would then have a list of third-party neutrals that they have already certified, and we would be seeking some grant funds that would then be available to those communities to support some of that work, should they want to do that. So it's a voluntary program that we believe there's a need for it, and so that's why we're trying to develop some sort of program that could provide support. And then back to Commissioner Stein's point, you know, the environmental review efficiency is really, it's kind of a combination of some of these things that are up there a la carte. It is the web tool. That was one of the top recommendations that came out of this board and your agencies, that it's about accessibility and transparency of data in these environmental review documents, so that project proposers and local communities who need to and want to do these reviews can look at others, compare and draw from that in an effort and do it real time to save time and potentially cost. But it also includes staff to do mandatory category rulemaking. We do have a 5-year report requirement that is in statute. The last report, I believe, was done in early 2013. So as we do that, we think it would be important to have staff that on a rolling basis can make those updates and rules so that the program does meet the needs of Minnesotans today. And that, you know, that can mean a number of things. It can mean not reviewing projects where agencies have sufficient experience, and we've learned that there's not the potential for environmental impact. But it could also mean, as you referenced, Commissioner Land, we're reviewing projects where currently maybe they're not required. So it's about meeting the needs of Minnesota today. So,
do you want to talk a little bit, Will, about process in terms of establishing a budget for the department and where we're at in that?
I can do that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for asking. As I try and condense this and try and make it linear so that we can, so that there are actually decisions that you all can make, we are working with the governor's office to submit it to and Minnesota Management and Budget to actually request funds. Creating a budget that goes into 16 and 17 is, without knowing whether or not our items are in the budget and whether or not the legislature deals with it, is kind of an impossible task. So it's this, what I really wanted to get out of today was some feedback, which I am getting, which has been really helpful about both priorities and how you would like this presented and how you would like these decisions. But really, those formal decisions are best made at the beginning of the fiscal year. So in 6 months, once the legislature has enacted their next biennial budget, then I can bring to you actual this or that kind of scenarios. But throughout the rest of the fiscal year, our work planning has really been a function of the planning that you have done, which was on a formal basis through the GICD. And so really what we're doing is coming out of that, and where we have resource constraints, rather than asking your input on prioritization.
Lack of money.
Yeah, thank you for the translation again. In those instances, I often find myself coming to many of you to ask for additional in-kind resources so we can accommodate this body of work to get through this fiscal year.
But generally speaking, the budget priorities, they have not been done in a vacuum. They are responding to the GICD. Commissioner Stein has been involved in this discussion. I've been involved with this discussion, as well as the governor's office up to this point. But again, I think you could use the term placeholder, I think, loosely. And so the actual work plan will be dependent upon where this board wants to go. So I just don't want you to leave feeling that the board was cut out in any way, shape, or form of those decisions. John?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just the mechanics of the state's accounting system are operated through our agency for the board. So their budget items are embedded as part of our budget submittal. Formerly, you might recall that EQB was administered under the Department of Administration, and it was transferred in the last 3.5 years ago. And so now it resides here. The staff are here. But the budget mechanics run through our financial office, and we make sure that Will has, the priorities as laid out are according to the discussions that occur before the board. So we're just sort of the vehicle to make sure everything gets in the process at the right place and the right time for the governor's review and decisions.
And at the end of the day, what we want is to be adequately resourced, I believe.
I think we need enough money to run the place, Dave.
Well,
that's plain.
Mm-hmm. My language.
All right. Other questions for Will? It's good to have you out there. Gives us a feeling of power.
I'm in the hot seat. Now I know what my staff go through.
Yeah, yeah. I'm reluctant to release you.
No, can I, Mr. Chair?
Oh, yes, good. Commissioner.
I just want to thank Will if you just think back 4 years, where we were, where the EQB funding was, and thank everyone for the collaboration among the agencies to, when we had to throw in dollars to adequately resource the things that we wanted to accomplish. That collaborative effort was there, and there was a commitment, and that's sort of the foundation, and you can see that you laid out the accomplishments of what we've done, as well as what we want to achieve and prioritizing those. And I just thought kudos to you. But also at the same time, I think it also shows we have a roadmap going forward, and also a time for us to reflect that we didn't have 4 years ago, for us commissioners, to take the opportunity before we even started to lay the foundation of what we need for the next biennium. So we wanted to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I was thinking of the song Proud Mary. You left a good job in the city working for the man every night and day, didn't you? Take this job. So thank you.
I appreciate that. Well, please, please don't be shy about sharing, offline too.
Yeah, I keep my day job.
I will keep you all updated, on a formal basis, but please don't hesitate to contact me individually if you have concerns or anything else going forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Will. All right. Megan, we're here to talk about the Environment and Energy Report Card, and welcome Megan Eichen, Communications, EQB, extraordinaire.
Thank you.
John, Brian, you're excused.
Thank you.
Megan,
good
welcome.
Afternoon, Chair Fredrickson and members of the board. I'm Megan Eichen. I lead the communications with the EQB. Today I want to talk to you about the Minnesota Environment and Energy Report Card update. Will, did you sabotage me?
I hope not.
Help is on its way.
A battery.
That's a song, too, John.
Yeah, we're going to start singing pretty quick, aren't we, Commissioner? This is the way this is going.
So back to our conversation about technology needs and our budget.
Which song do you want to sing, John?
I like the adequately resourced roadmap. Can we just go back to that?
Commissioner Zelli, absolutely.
John,
pick up on that.
I can propose a song. George Harrison's "Here Comes the Sun." Maybe we could all sing along. And
who walks? You carry this in your pocket? Of course you do. I knew that.
Track 7 of the Abbey Road album. Let's go.
Just in case you need.
Ed's got that.
Thank you, Ed.
Ready to roll, Megan.
All right. Today I want to talk with you about the Minnesota Environmental and Energy Report Card and ask you for your recommendations on how to fulfill the directive in Executive Order 1132. This order states that the EQB will annually create an energy report card for the state of Minnesota to measure the progress protecting our natural resources. The first report card was created as a companion document to go with the 2013 Environmental Congress. People from across state government worked hard to identify metrics, compile data, and to create the piece that you have in front of you. Agency staff has been working on updating these graphs with current information, and today we'll have a number of them present to you on what has changed and what hasn't. As you hear their presentations, please consider the following so we can take from you what you believe to be the best way to update this information. Please keep in mind the following items as you hear from the presenters. What are the communications goals for putting something like this together for 2015? Is it the legislative agenda setting to support agencies? Is it public education? Is it an online resource? Who is the audience? Would we want to focus on the public? Does it make more sense to target the agencies and the legislature with this update, or potentially even different industries? There are a number of ways we could approach this, so we hope you ask questions and offer feedback about how the EQB should release the 2015 version of this piece. We could utilize a combination of these options as well. Does it make sense to have this solely as electronic graphics on the EQB website? Should we create a printed one-page executive summary? Would the full update of the existing report in a printed format be the most effective? Or does it make sense to keep this document as a companion document to the Environmental Congress? In just a moment, experts from three agencies will talk about the highlights of the new data that we've been working with. Todd Bewin, MPCA Assistant Division Director, Andy Holdsworth, DNR, Data and Performance Management Supervisor, and Steve Loomis, Commerce, Principal Planner. These three have been coordinating and number crunching and doing the heavy lifting, gathering and translating this data. Thanks to all three of them, and a special thank you to Steve, who delayed his retirement by 2 weeks so that he could be here to help present with us.
Can I just say that's the commitment of Commerce staff?
Shameless.
Here's an example of how the graphs will look as we walk through the presentations. You'll see a graphic on the screen which includes the most up-to-date information with a corresponding page number. The page number refers to the original version in the 2013 booklet in front of you so that you can see the changes or trends. As we walk through these, please keep in mind the following. Our objectives. What do we want to achieve with this report card information? As I mentioned before, who is our target audience? The public or the legislature, potentially? What are the resources available for working on the document? Printing budget, agency staff time, are we adequately resourced, as Will mentioned earlier? Evaluation of the project, what does success look like? Are there any missing metrics, or are there metrics that can be taken out? And what is the appropriate frequency to compile this data to tell a good story? Is it annually, is it every 5 years, or is it over the course of a decade? What we hope to determine from your input is what your recommendations are for us to move forward on the project. Please ask questions, have a discussion, and give us feedback. Tell us if you see any themes that particularly stand out to you as an important message, who this information would make the most sense to communicate it with, and what does the final product look like? Electronic graphics, a print piece of some kind, or if it makes sense to have this as a companion document the next time a Congress is held. Also, does this fit into the greater strategic communications for the EQB? And are we being redundant with other agencies? For example, the dashboard that MMB has created. So if you don't have any questions for me, I'll invite the agency experts up here to discuss the graphs.
Questions for Megan, John?
So Megan, I know we're going to see all the graphs again, but before we go there, and I'm wondering if the presenters, and this may not for you, but the report itself listed in every section key questions to consider, and they kind of lay out rhetorical state. They're not all that easily answered if you look at them, and I wonder if while we can update the report, my greater question is, can we respond to the questions? And so I just would like to know if any of the presenters, as you think about what you're going to speak to, and you look at those key questions to consider in each of the subject areas, that to me would be, those are kind of the ponderous things that the Congress left us with. And to me, I'm kind of intrigued by trying to put some more substance to a response to those questions. I don't mind updating the graphics, I think that's fine. But I just would like to hear from the presenters about those key questions, if possible.
And I'll leave that to them to answer as you go throughout the presentation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Chris?
The questions you just asked us a few moments ago in terms of feedback, is that something that you want now, or will it be at the end of the presentations?
Whichever you feel more comfortable with. If you would like to have a conversation about it, if you'd like to think about it and email me later, I'm happy to accept comments that way too.
Okay. I guess I do have just a general comment, because I was aware of Will's discussion of how much was put into the public engagement for the Environmental Congress. And I actually printed out the whole record. And I have a lot of interest in seeing us make something more of that investment, with the potential to actually, the question is, would there be some benefits in recirculating the update with the questions and with some of the questions you asked us into that set of stakeholders whose addresses and names we still have? Would that be something that would help us continue to build the constituency for this discussion and how could we use that public engagement record and more, even more, the public engagement group to continue to examine this resource.
Megan, Will.
That's a great idea, and we can certainly work with you to figure out how we can best execute something like that.
I think Kristen's really on something. I mean, when we think of environmental review, one of the first things we do in environmental review is a scoping. And we had sort of a time crunch in our hands when we did this first one, and so we sort of developed the report card to go out to the people to tell them what we thought. And, you know, some of the things in here are really useful. Some of them are not. I mean, the land use, you know, if you look at page 7, land use, well, it doesn't change over 10 years substantially. It doesn't change substantially over 40 years. And so I'm not certain that that's a particularly good metric in this publication. So I wonder if the first thing we do is if we ask people, you know, what's important to you, what should we be measuring, and then develop the report card around that.
Mr. Chair, this goes with a little bit. I mean, Will, you asked the question, you know, about the Environmental Congress. Some of this was tied with that as we were going through, and kind of they were feeding off each other, and we had that dialogue. So that was a good question earlier, but at the same time, maybe there's a way in which we can, incorporate that, those questions up front again as we proceed to develop this for the next time, or this time, I mean.
Beer.
And I guess to board members and Megan, when this report card was initiated, I understood it was kind of a first stab at this. We'll look at what data we have and can present, then get feedback from the public on what they want to see. So I think there could be some good information in what Kristen was saying, and maybe re-identify metrics. Do we need to collect additional data, that sort of thing, and reallocate? It's kind of as a starting point to bring those comments back in as we look at the metrics to address and updates.
All right. Megan, you're the floor manager here.
So. I'll bring up the experts.
Welcome, Todd. Andy and Steve, welcome all of you. Steve, thanks for putting off your retirement. But as someone who has flunked retirement, it's not all it has cracked up to be. So we'll see you back in a year or so. Your wife will say something along the lines, I'm okay with the until death do us part, but I'm not okay with you being home for lunch, so go find a job. You already heard that, all right.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the board. It's great to hear, harken back to the Environmental Congress that this was really built for. That was a really incredible effort. And
may I interrupt and remind Todd that, you know, what happened in Worthington and Marshall stays in Worthington Marshall post meetings that we had there. Okay. Deal? Deal?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Go.
Deal. So we're going to try to go through these quickly. We're trying to be comprehensive to show how these graphics have changed. Sometimes the actual data has changed. Sometimes what the data is in the form of the graph has changed. And many times there hasn't been a great change in the last few years. These were really meant to be generally trends, longer-term trends. And so in many cases, we might not expect to see too much change over just the course of 2 or 3 years. So first, we're going to tag team based on which agency was responsible for producing this data. This is Minnesota water use by category. This is billions of gallons of water from 1985 to 2013, ordered from the biggest user, including power generation, which is more borrowing the water to cool power plants. It's not consumptive use as much, but also water supply systems, residential, public water supply, industrial and processing and irrigation and other uses. So this is actually quite an interesting one. If you look at 2010, before that, it was pretty flat. And so since 2010, continuing to last year, you do see this overall decline, which is really in the power generation category. Now that's generally thought that that is an example of the nexus between energy production and water use, and that as we have moved more towards natural gas as a fuel source, requiring less water to cool those plants than, say, coal-fired coal plants. And you'll see that change and that composition of how we consume and produce energy in the later section. So this one did show some change.
Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Kate.
Thank you. And Andy, I'm just curious about the decision to put consumptive and borrowed use. I don't remember the technical term. Basically, there is a difference if it's going through a cooling plant, cooling tower, versus if it's going into irrigation or in someone's home.
Right.
Or does the DNR not?
So this is a very good question. Traditionally, we have really just focused on consumptive use. As I think we've broadened our connection between water use and water quality, non-consumptive use of power plant extracting water above it to cool it off, tailwater is coming further downstream. There's a change in that water. It's often a higher temperature. It can be a place where and sometimes invasive species are harbored, so it has secondary effects beyond water use. And so the point is it can have, it's something to be concerned of, mm-hmm. about, but it is different than consumptive use that, our focus is much more on that overall where we are, extracting groundwater and it's hard to get that back into the ground. Is that helpful?
Yeah, I just think it's as someone who knows a fair bit about this, it's hard for me to kind of visualize, okay, as we're thinking about consumptive use and as we have less water to use, where do I need to be concerned? Because power generation just is such a big part of this graph. It's a small point, but I think it's harder for me to kind of wrap my head around what we're tracking with this.
So that's a good point, and I think that is part of the discussion about how we need to maybe change these metrics and refocus them moving forward. Another important thing I will say, the general public was very much the audience when we put this together in the beginning, and so we wanted to paint the bigger picture of how are we using our land. It hasn't changed a whole lot, but what is the proportion of different forests versus agricultural lands, for instance? And same thing here. What's the bigger picture of our water use? Power generation uses a lot of water, but, it's just kind of borrowing it. But so that was the intention of doing it this way before moving forward, where to be more strategic about critical issues, yes, it might make sense to present this data differently.
Eric? I just had a real quick comment about future, how to show the data. It looks to me that this is surface water and groundwater appropriations data clumped together, correct?
Yes.
Maybe tease that out.
Yeah.
So you can see surface water consumption versus groundwater consumption is two separate rather than one. Just a suggestion.
Yeah, that's a good point. So that one was a great one. I thought it'd be a good one to start with to get you really engaged.
Mission accomplished.
We do have a lot to get through, too. Okay.
Nitrates.
This is health. How are we going to cover this, Megan? Okay, thank you. So this is a number of community water systems by their maximum nitrate concentration. So blue being the lowest concentration, being the lowest concentration. Blue being the lowest concentration. And down at the bottom, purple being the highest concentration. So this has not changed in terms of the distribution of these concentrations of what we've measured.
Those numbers are based on Department of Health's gathering of data as of 2013. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
This next one is from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I'll just introduce myself. I'm Todd Bewin with the agency. And this is really about activity, doing work, than it is about an environmental outcome. This is about how the agency is monitoring the state's surface waters, lake streams and rivers, and it just shows our progress in trying to meet our 10-year cycle of completing all 81 watersheds in the 10-year period following the passage of the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. So we're on track. Actually, I just checked today, and for 2014, we're up to 72% through 2014. So that bar can be added here pretty quickly as soon as we wrap up that work. But so this is pretty simple. Any questions about this one?
Sure.
John?
You know, one thing that the agencies collectively worked on in the last couple of years is trying to look at the expenditures out of the Clean Water Fund and the level of water quality impairments. Those were roughly aggregated by lake clarity and fish IBI, which is an index of biological integrity. And that isn't the same as this graph, which is an activity graph about how complete is our picture of the state when it comes to monitoring our watersheds. And I think when we get into this water quality and groundwater monitoring component of our work, the roadmap conversation might be a better set of indicators, and engaging the public in that might be more productive than using this, which just says we're meeting our commitment of getting around and monitoring watersheds of the state. That I think what this lacks is any kind of it doesn't tell the story of what's the quality in public terms. How are the lakes and rivers of the state doing from a water quality perspective? Nor does it really speak to what's our expectation for the future. So I would suggest we think about that roadmap as a tool to replace or at least supplement this information, because I think this helps people know that we're getting our job done, but it doesn't tell them what the quality of our water resources are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, thanks, Tom is reminding me, on page 3 of the report is the impaired versus unimpaired percentage of our water resources. That graph hasn't changed in over 10 years and probably isn't likely to change very much in the future. And it's really just not descriptive enough for average people to get a sense of where we're going. So the roadmap, the Clean Water Roadmap, that a number of the agencies work to try to describe conditions in present and future would be, I think, a little bit more illustrative of how we're doing with our water quality and some things on groundwater as well.
Kristen, and then let's see if we can hold questions until the end of the session, but please.
Well, I guess this is a general comment with reference to this specific item.
Well, that's totally different
okay.
then.
Okay. Well, no. I guess I'm agreeing with Commissioner Stein, and I'm just saying that if one of our goals is to empower the people of Minnesota to engage in these goals and these questions, I think there's a lot that could be made used if it were linked to this kind of report. I think we have a pretty sophisticated public out there, and so I would really like to see the kinds of additions that you're talking about.
Todd.
Okay, the next slide is at the bottom of page 3 there, and it not a lot of change here. It's about water clarity, and the largest bar is that there's in the middle where there's no significant change in the water clarity of our surface waters. Probably the good news is that we're seeing improvement in more water bodies than we're seeing degradation. So that right bar is a little larger than the left bar, but not a lot of change here. And you wouldn't expect in a 2-year period to see a lot of change in water bodies. But we have some improving, some degrading, which we'd rather see none degrading, but we are seeing about 1 in 10 getting less cleanly. So any questions about this one? We were asked to be concise, especially where there's not much change, but to spend a little more time where there is change. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do. The next slide, this is a good story. This is about phosphorus in the Minnesota River that is released into the Minnesota River from wastewater treatment plants. And this is really about permitting, good compliance among the facilities that or the communities that operate wastewater plants. 71% reduction in wastewater phosphorus in a 10-year period. And we have those dotted, those hash lines are our goals, and we really exceeded those goals ahead of where we thought we would. So this is a good story. Point sources are doing quite well, and where we're really challenged is in non-point and trying to hold the line in those areas. Any questions on this one? Okay.
Okay, this is on the Healthy Aquatic Life and Ecosystems section at the bottom of page 4. This is a focus on high-profile aquatic invasive species, zebra mussels. As you can see, the form of this metric has changed. And this is, you know, of course, many of our lakes and streams are connected. And so often when we designate a water as infested, you know, we need to include those connections. So just by another lake being infested, it's more significant when that infestation was due to overland spread. You know, the active movement of zebra mussels on a boat trailer and such to another lake. And so this is a metric that focuses on the overland spread, showing the number of lakes each year that has been infested. So from 1989 to 2007, you know, just about one lake per year. But then you see since then, you know, up to 3 to 5 per year. So this we consider this a better metric to show the extent of the challenge of overland spread and the importance of activities to prevent that spread between lakes. Any questions? So I'm going to, we included these several fish species here, common ones that are familiar to most Minnesotans. The short of it here, these trends in each of these species has not changed. These are just arrows based on the longer term trend of the data. I think I'll leave it at that.
So that's the end of the water section. Is there anything we want to stop at all there and before we move into land?
Do you want to answer the first question of key questions to consider?
Yeah. Let's tough questions.
Let's hear your take on those, Todd.
We didn't sign up for that, exactly. Commissioner Stein.
He's a little bit of a wild card, Todd, as you might know. So, I apologize for that.
Sorry. Take a pass.
Okay. Next slide.
Okay, this is at the bottom of page 7 about managing our cropland, showing two major strategies that farmers would use to protect, you know, soil water quality habitat. That being conservation tillage, shown in that. These green points here as increasing since 89. We haven't tracked that since 2008, so there's no additional data there. And then it also shows the number of acres in land retirement programs, such as the Conservation Reserve Program, showing that that continued decline since 2007, where lands are not being re-renewed into conservation reserve and wetland reserve program. That's a Bowser-led metric that I'm merely reporting on. So I do understand there is a proposal from the Clean Water Council actually to renew the monitoring of conservation tillage.
Andy, who did that in the past?
What's that?
Who did that monitoring in the past?
I'm not sure. Would it be? I mean, I think it was. I'm sorry, I don't know, Commissioner.
potato farm.
Do you know Commissioner Fredrickson?
Could be, I don't know, could it be Bowser, possibly? I don't know. And how far back would you want to speculate that it was going on? 2, 3, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, was somebody doing it, or?
Well, as far as I know, ended in 2008. And when we were doing this report, we were actually struggling for a metric here.
Okay.
And so it was something that was available, and at that point, it wasn't too far in the past, and there was probably hope that it would continue. And in this case, it hasn't continued, and so it's looking more.
Dan Gilchrist is here, and maybe there was some work being done at the University of Minnesota. That's a strong possibility. Maybe, Dan, when you get up, you can speculate like the rest of us. Yeah. Golly, I don't know. Please.
This is a metric about forest land management status. There's been no change in these trends, but we have a variety of ways in which we protect the diverse forest values. We have a third of the state in forest, and all the green and orange colors. About 6% of that is in reserved lands, such as the boundary waters, national parks, some state parks, but shows, again, the significant increase, but is stable now of the about half of the acres being certified by third parties as being sustainably managed. So that is not increasing, but it's steady. There's two slides here on a selection of Minnesota wildlife species showing their longer-term trends over the last 20 years. Again, the general trends for each of these species in terms of what the arrows say is the same as what it was in 2012. You see that decline in pheasants, for instance, since 2005. That's part of a much longer, bigger decline, and was, of course, the topic of the Pheasant Summit just this past weekend. So we have focused on some high-profile species. You can look at the next slide. Everything from spring peepers, pine martens, but also moose, and showing that continued long decline with a recent small uptick in the population surveys of the last year.
Okay. How do we manage your solid waste in Minnesota? The amount of solid waste generated in Minnesota really tracks pretty well with the economy and how healthy the economy is. So this doesn't tell us the size of the pie. It tells us of the waste generated in Minnesota, how is it managed? The change from the report you have in front of you to the slide is that the good news is that 5% less is being landfilled, 5 to 6% less is being landfilled, and that's really flipped over into the recycling category, which is a good story. The new chart also does include an organics management piece, which has become much more of a focus in the last few years, and so is reflected here. It wasn't reflected in the previous chart. So that is it for land. Into air now. This is MPCA is holds most of the cards on air as far as doing the monitoring and assessing where we are with air quality. So I'll be talking about a few slides here. This is really the red line is really the standard, the federal standards, and the other lines show how do we compare to those standards. And with the exception of a blip in 2010 for fine particles, we have maintained compliance with federal standards. In fact, that 1 year blip did not put us out of compliance with federal standards because of the averaging times and things associated with that. But the good news is if you look at each of these lines for ozone and fine particles, we have trended downward. So air quality in the state continues to improve. We're still challenged by changing regulations. And the latest one that we're hearing about is ozone, that sometime later in 2015 they may lower the standard and put us real close to, it's kind of unknown at this time whether we're going to be in or out of compliance with that. But air quality continues to improve. And standards will challenge us in the future is kind of the soundbite there. Days with air quality alerts, and this is actually in the MMB dashboard, the statewide dashboard. This showing the number of air quality alerts in the state over the last 10 years. And in 2014, we're sitting on 2 days, so that's as green as well. While the trend looks great, the reality is that there's not a lot of control that we can work on reducing emissions, but a lot of this is weather dependent. And if we had a weather episode of hot, stagnant air in the summer, we could quickly jump up here into yellow and red. But we've been lucky, and as I said, emissions do continue to go down. So
most recently, the air quality alerts that you saw on the freeway signs were related to what level of particle or ozone?
Yes,
or
particles whatever. And just the weather inversion trapping
threat
those.
That's your department to put those up, Charlie. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easier to say that than happy birthday, John.
And those were actually advisories, so we didn't actually trigger. We stayed below the magic 100 number, but we were nearing that, so we were putting out the advisories.
And you think was it temperature related, I suspect, because of the
warmer temperatures at the ground trapped. Yeah. Yes, where the pollutants.
And happy birthday, John.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner Fredrickson. But I'll also just, you know, while we attribute a lot of the air alerts to inversions and meteorology, there's a lot that we contribute. I mean, that's the sources.
There were some directives included in the air quality work. Consider idling, and I've been idling for most of my life.
As long as you turn the engine off while you idle, Mr. Chair, that's fine.
Oh, that's what I
thank
missed.
You.
Yeah.
Don't idle. And I just have to say thanks to Commissioner Zelli. That conversation between this agency and MnDOT took 20 years to come to fruition for those signs to actually be used for that purpose. And there was a long, long debate about the value of issuing those alerts. And yes, it did happen on my birthday. So thank you, Commissioner Zelli. It's a great birthday present.
It turns out it wasn't that hard to do.
You're cooperating then. Well, that's good.
Thanks.
Okay, next chart is, let's see, what page are we on now? Page 12, major sources of air pollution. And it's hard to look at a pie chart from one report to another and really see what's going on. But a little bit more of what's behind here is that the size of the pie is really being reduced. So just for numbers' sake, in 2000, there was about 1.3 million tons of emissions to the air in Minnesota. And that has been reduced by a third. So in 2013, we're at about 800,000. So you don't see the size of the pie change in what we've presented here. So that's a problem, and it points to how we can improve this metric. The other thing that's interesting here is that highway vehicles, while they used to be the largest piece of the pie, are no longer the largest piece of the pie. It's actually fires, urban use of particulate matter that's emitted from recreational fires and other miscellaneous things like that. So they're kind of running neck and neck, but it's pretty interesting that that actually is right there as far as the amount of emissions with motor vehicles. So it says a lot about vehicles and how they've been cleaned up and fuels have been cleaned up, but also just the size of the pie is reduced, but there's different sources now that are taking the lead on that. So that's not reflected in the reports. So there's probably better ways that we could present information for that. There's a lot going on with this one. Starting from the top, you know, the real gross state product increases over time. This is a 20-year chart, 20 years of information. Vehicle miles traveled are leveling off. Energy consumption has dropped over the last 5 years. That's the green line. The orange line, greenhouse gas emissions have come down a little bit. Some of that's related to the economy and the health of the economy, as we see some of that bumping up again. But population is the purple line. But the good news here is that while we see increases in population and the GDP, the aggregate emissions continue to go down. So there's more efficiency and more control over, especially over point sources. These charts show the same thing, that over the, each block is a 10-year period for lead, particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, sulfur oxides, and then volatile organic compounds. All are showing pretty significant reductions over the 10-year period. And then mercury emissions to the air in Minnesota. This is on page 13. We've just added a bar for 2011, which shows a downward trend. We have a long way to go to get to our goal in 2025. The significant reduction so far has been in energy production related to coal. And there's a couple things happening. One is that we're burning less coal in the state as some of our production changes over to renewables. The second factor is a lot of control on the smokestacks, which are, you know, federal and state requirements for that, and also compliance within the industry on those things. So where we're going to be looking now in the future is emissions from mining and from the purposeful use of mercury, and we're going to need some big reductions there to reach our goal.
Okay. My name is Steve Loomis, and I'm at Department of Commerce, and I'm basically on the sort of the data support side. I do have Lise Trudeau here with me in case we get down into the details. She's more knowledgeable and involved from that standpoint. So I'm sure I'll be deferring a few questions to her. Let's see. Okay. So this first chart actually was not in the previous report card. It was felt that we should have a plot that showed the total energy consumption over time. And as you can see, in general, over the last 10, 12 years, the total energy consumption in the state has basically plateaued. Be a little careful when looking at the first, say, third of that time period, because there's a scale change there. Those first increments are five-year increments, and then starting in 2000, it's one-year increments. So that slope at the beginning there really isn't quite as steep as it appears, and in fact, we probably ought to have some little dashed line or demarcation, something, a notation that the horizontal scale has changed. Or we could even literally start the x-axis a little later than 1965. That was just an attempt to be consistent with the next plot. So this is basically just extending the plot that was the first chart on the, in the energy section from the last report card. And it pretty much just continues the same general trend showing on a per capita basis. The energy consumption is still relatively level. You might be able to eyeball a little decrease, but at the same time, you have to realize that, of course, that real blip down was during the recession. And so there's a significant drop in the energy consumption, and so we're still kind of coming back from that. And then one of the things that maybe Anna Henderson might even touch on in her discussion later on is that there's really kind of been a reduced tie over time between the energy usage and economic growth. So it's kind of the more efficient we get, the more economically competitive the state becomes. So that's a good thing. The next plot is really just for all practical purposes, virtually no change from the previous report card. The consumption by the different sectors, transportation, industrial, residential, and so on, really has not changed for all practical purposes, distribution of who's using the energy. And then when you put it in a different context, where is the energy being consumed? This chart is actually, again, very similar to the previous, see this is page 16, to the previous report card, in that the majority of the usage is for electricity, And by all sources, what that's implying is that natural gas is used to produce electricity, nuclear, wind, solar, hydro, coal for electricity. That's what the, in parentheses, all sources is implying, whereas the natural gas category is, for other purposes, heating and so on. Petroleum and ethanol is obviously majority is used for transportation purposes, but the percentages essentially have not changed from a couple of years ago in the previous report. Then the next two slides are really kind of supposed to go together, and you can see them side by side in the previous report where compared 2000 to 2010. And this is zeroing in more on just the electricity consumption specifically. So this is just a reiteration of the 2000 numbers. And you can see 62% of the electricity consumption was generated by the use of coal. And if you move on to 2012, we've dropped again even a bit from the 2010 chart in the previous report. We've dropped down to 44% of the fuel source was from coal. Now, as it's been reminded or pointed out to me, much of that could be due to Sherco 3 being offline for late November to late November 2011 into late 2013. But that reduction in the coal usage was essentially made up for with additional contribution from wind, which went from about 1% up to 13% between 2000 and 2012, and also an increase with natural gas, probably much of that due to lower natural gas prices. But like was pointed out before, the pie chart, you're not seeing the actual magnitude, you're just seeing percentages. But it turns out between 2000 and 2012, the actual amount of electricity consumed was actually fairly similar. So these distributions between the different components are actually relatively meaningful because the total magnitude is pretty close between those 2 years. Then if we go to, this was an additional chart, a new chart that was decided to add to look at a little bit more of the breakdown of the renewable energy consumption. And this essentially replaces the chart that was at the bottom of page 16 in the lower left, which was just a pie chart. We thought it probably made more sense to show the change in renewable energy consumption over time and what's contributing to that. Mm-hmm. And you can see that since 2006 or so, the amount of renewable energy consumed has gone up significantly. And when you look at the red line in there, you can see that wind tends to be the major contribution to that increased renewable energy consumption.
Steve?
Yes?
Just one observation, the proportions in the pie chart, recognizing that's year 2010, are different than the 2010 proportions in there. For instance, in the pie chart, it shows 50% of the renewable being wood and wood waste, but you're not anywhere near that with the lines there, best I can tell.
As far as the new chart you're saying?
Right.
I know that there were slightly different breakdowns, certainly, with regard to where some of the components fell. I'll be sure and take a look at that to see where that lands. If you look at this, wood, waste, ethanol, that's about, looks like, what, 90,000? That's a little more than half currently, it looks like, compared to the renewable total. In 2010, 90,000 billion BTU versus about 150. So that looks like that's probably a little, this number looks like it's a little high compared to that pie chart. But we'll make sure and take a look at that.
And I guess this actually breaks wood waste and ethanol apart. The pie chart does.
Right. Yeah. We'll take a look at that.
Yeah, a good point. Yes.
Okay.
Oh, it's lumped in. Oh, I got you.
Which I think, it, frankly, is a useful right. distinction, exactly. keeping them separate.
Okay.
Being a guy who sells trees.
Okay, so the next chart is basically, move over to page 17, just a little redo of the portion of the Minnesota electric generation from the renewable sources, breaking out Xcel again relative to the other utilities. And so the dashed and dotted lines are, in essence, the goals, the requirements for Xcel and the other utilities sort of lumped together as to what their goals are over time. Those are those stair step patterns of the dashed and dotted lines. And then the bars showing how Xcel and the other utilities have, in fact, met their requirements. And they are meeting their percentage of their electric generation from renewable sources, and they are well prepared to meet those requirements going forward. They're using, of course, renewable energy credits that have been banked, and so Lise could help describe that in a little more detail as to how that's going to be handled going forward. Basically showing that they are meeting those requirements.
Steve, before you leave that, is the solar mandate, the new 1.5% solar mandate included in that?
Welcome, Elise.
Thanks. We love data. I'm glad that you guys do too. So the 1.5% is included in here, and it's kind of hard to see in the chart. But you can see the end line for the red one for Xcel goes a little above 30, so that's 31.5. And then the other utilities are sort of a collection of munis, co-ops, and other IOUs that are not Xcel. And that comes out to about 0.5% on top of the existing requirements for those utilities. And so in 2025, that comes up to about 25.5. And there's a little footnote there.
Got it. So, I mean, it just, I think people's natural inclination is to ask where that renewable, what are the renewable sources that each of the utilities are crediting? I mean, that's sort of the, I think, if there's a way for us to clarify that in this graph, that would be interesting. I don't know if it's possible or if there's a rational way of doing it, but people want to know how much of that renewable generation is from what source by utility.
By utility, okay.
Because that starts to, well, it just tells a different story. This is a good aggregate story, and I think it's fine. I just think people want to know who's doing what. And if that's public information and is relevant, we should, I'd like to see us report that.
Excellent. We do collect all kinds of information. And we are also definitely curious about those same questions. You know, each chart kind of begs a backstory. And so, yeah, it's just the question of adequate resources. I don't see Mike Rothman here anymore, so unfortunately.
We'll let him know. We'll let him know you put the right pitch in.
Okay, the next two charts, I'll just go back and forth here for a second. One of them is for electric, and one of them is for natural gas utilities. This is basically reflecting the energy efficiency requirements through the CIP program, Conservation Improvement Program. And they're essentially replacing the chart from the previous report in the lower right corner of page 17. It was decided that that previous chart was a little bit sort of mixing apples and oranges in some ways. And so these two charts, the natural gas and electric utility charts we have here, are specifically using numbers from our conservation improvement program. And the data source is the reporting energy savings platform that all the utilities have to submit their energy savings for the year. That information gets vetted by folks at Commerce, a lot of back and forth to make sure that those numbers are defensible. And there are a lot of caveats, I guess you might say, or assumptions that go into these numbers. The actual numbers, the y-axis is the incremental savings in both charts. And those incremental savings mean these are the annualized energy savings from new energy efficiency measures implemented during the year shown. So think about it, if some new energy efficiency measures were put into place 3 years ago, they're obviously still contributing some energy savings over time relative to whether or not they had ever been implemented. That's not truly included in here in a given year. These are the incremental first year savings for any new measures, because that's the way the utilities are graded in the Conservation Improvement Program. And then likewise, those savings are compared against a 3-year moving average of the energy consumed, essentially. And even that 3-year average is different between utilities. So it's a relatively confusing set of assumptions behind the scenes, but it was still determined by Commerce folks anyway that these are the numbers that the utilities get graded on, and that we probably ought to be truly showing the charts as to how the utilities are in fact being graded. So we'll have to decide, you know, in any kind of narrative, how's that going to be explained without just getting so deep into the weeds. But that's what these two charts are trying to show, and they're truly more accurate than the previous chart, just a little more complicated.
Kristen.
Mr. Chair, are the, just from a public perspective, that is mind-boggling. And I read those, and I know how complicated it is, but I've never understood it. Is the original chart where they're just kind of laid out like that together, is that actually inaccurate in a way that's not fair to utilities?
Steve?
Whether it's fair or not to the utilities, I guess I don't know. When we dug down into the details, it was using energy savings as reported by the utilities with their very specific requirements of how they report those savings compared to Energy Information Administration numbers for a single year. And then trying to layer on the required percentage, the 1% target for gas, the 1.5% target for electricity. Well, it's not calculating that average properly, because that average truly is that percentage reduction truly is based against this 3-year moving average for each utility, each having a different baseline. So it was really honestly kind of combining apples and oranges, and so it's a fairly complicated process.
Yeah.
To say it was wrong is not necessarily true, but it's not, the previous one was probably not really accurate. If somebody said, are the gas companies meeting the 1%? Are the electric utilities meeting the 1.5%? That previous chart could have shown yes or no, but the real situation as to what they have to meet are these percentages, and that's what their goals are. So I'm not sure. I know that sort of answers your question, but it's a complicated. You have a different way of explaining.
Yeah, I guess if the point is to show the report card how we're doing,
yeah, the usefulness.
Saving is we should use a metric that more accurately reflects the policy.
Thank you,
Eric.
I guess I had just a comment about your comment about the complexity. It's not very clear cut. And I guess it comes down to Megan's point at the very beginning about audience. And yeah, I guess that's something to think about with these metrics, how the report card's getting updated and for what audience, because honestly, not being an energy utility person,
it doesn't mean much.
It means absolutely nothing. And, you know, I understand, too, that, you know, there are goals that are set that
utilities need to meet. And, you know, just the point to, and I don't know if I understood Commissioner Stein's comment about source of energy, if when he said source he meant wind, solar, or
other renewable.
Well, what was the, I forget the term, where they're banking credits.
Yeah.
Oh.
If credits was a source.
That's interesting.
Too. Mm-hmm. And I guess we see in this chart, sorry, that step chart, that one there. Mm-hmm. It's getting hit right on, and I would expect that it's going to get hit right on through 2030. How that's achieved, I think, is where at least sometimes the public has questions. Mm-hmm. You know, is it credits? Is it actually renewable growth? Are they putting up more? That sort of thing. So coming back around to this type of metric, it may be useful to utility folks, industry people, but I guess for a general report card, I guess I would question it.
That's my point, I guess.
When it's so complicated.
Absolutely. These are all excellent questions.
Average or, you know, moving average. And
Matt?
I was going to ask, thank you. Is the baseline also constantly changing or being recomputed as the economy changes and consumption patterns change, or is it a, what's happening to the baseline itself?
My understanding, maybe Lise can chime in also, is that that average, that three-year average that they use literally is a moving average. So that gets reset based on the some of the regulatory submittals by each utility. And so mm-hmm. one utility may have a baseline of 2007 and they go 2007, 8, 9. Another utility may have a baseline of 2010 and it's 2010, 11, 12. So it's recomputed in that every 3 years they have a new baseline that they can work with, is my understanding.
That so, the utilities file a triennial report with their plan, and the targets are based on that plan and those goals.
And 1% is not here.
Okay. Are there questions or this one?
I have a quick question. Is it easy to translate these numbers into generation that's offset? And so maybe the best way to depict it is, you know, is power that's otherwise not used. And so you could, you know, calculate that to a dollar figure or to an environmental outcome instead of maybe just whether or not you're hitting 1%. Because I think the reason for my question is it is leading in that I think, you know, the conservation program is one of the most amazing success stories in energy policy in terms of offsetting coal generation and creating jobs, as we learned at our, you know, at our last meeting. And so it does, you see 1.6, 1.7%, you think that doesn't really, that seems boring, but it's really massive what it's doing. And so I'm just throwing that out there in case there's a better metric to demonstrate what good is actually being accomplished.
Yeah,
that's a really good question. And I think it's, you know, as we start to dive into the CZO project, you know, you can start to see how what we do impacts the resources that we have in the state, and sometimes that depends on what time of day the measure kicks in. So if you're, you know, you have a lighting efficiency measure that happens during the day, that might have a different impact than shifting load, shifting demand to the nighttime, where you tend to use more coal. And so each measure has a different greenhouse gas impact depending on what time of day. And you could do a study of that, you know, based on modeling that's been done and actual measurements of what happens when you increase or decrease total energy demand at a given time of day based on our region, based on the emissions monitoring. And that's some of the things that we're looking at with CZO. But it would be complicated.
As long as it was adequately resourced.
Adequately resourced,
The last two ought to be pretty straightforward. This was a plot
of Minnesota, essentially wind potential. Both this and the next one that we discussed putting in, which is essentially a solar potential, you know, these really aren't metrics per se that the state has any bearing on, really, in terms of, you know, modifying. So the first one was in last year's report, and we sort of thought, well, if there's a wind potential, maybe that's a little unfair to not include some kind of solar potential. Alternatively, flip side, does it make sense that either one of them should be in there if you're looking at actual metrics that can be impacted by activities in the state? So that would be a question for folks to think about. So that's the end of the energy section.
I assume that the tax extender bill that was signed at the federal level will probably impact some of the development activities that will be going on in terms of wind and solar generation, which is kind of good news, I would think, for those that are out there in that business. So that's good to see.
If you were to look at our projected growth in solar, that's going to, it hasn't quite kicked in yet, but it's about to hit the hockey stick.
And that will be a huge help, I'm guessing, the tax incentives that will be forthcoming from the federal effort. Yesterday, they signed off on it.
Oh, wow, you're way more in the loop than I am.
I just came back, you know, from D.C., yeah. Which, I mean, you're out of the loop in some respects, but in the loop in others. So I'm out of the loop here right now. I'm getting back to it. So.
You're in the loop, Dan.
I'm sure that'll be very helpful.
I doubt it. Thanks. If
the next chart is greenhouse gas emissions. The MPCA conducts greenhouse gas emission inventory, compiles the numbers, and the most recent data for this chart is 2010, shows a little downturn related, we think, to the economy. Not sure where this is going. You may all be talking about these issues more than I know, and I think we'll probably... your CZO and things, you're probably pretty on top of this, but this is just an update from the chart that's in the report.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to keep the goals on there, because I, even if we're not on track to meet the most immediate one next year, in a few weeks, I think it's important for Minnesotans to know that those are our goals, statutory goals.
Good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do not have them on this one, so
agreed.
It's a good catch.
Last one.
We got the last four here. So this is, again, in the climate section. This is data from our state climatology office. This is the first one about our average annual temperatures in Minnesota, which over the last century have increased by about 2.3 degrees Fahrenheit. And the increase, all of these have been, the numbers are a little different because the data has been improved in terms of the methodology used. But there's been a larger increase in the last 30 years of 4.1 degrees Fahrenheit, and this is the average annual temperature. Same trend, slightly different data. Next one is one that's relates to dew points. So the the number of dew point, the days where the dew point temperature is above 70 degrees. That's what the tropics feels like. And so this isn't a statistically significant increase. But we all know, you know, it's humidity that really affects our ability to deal with heat. So this has very important health impacts, people and animals. So in the last 30 years, there's been some more years with an exceptional number of days with a dew point above 70 degrees. So it's just to bring that aspect, important health impacts of that. The next chart is another just indicator of how our climate is changing in the state in terms of lakes and ice out. Here we're using a single lake, Lake Osakis, just east of Alexandria, as a proxy for the whole set of lakes that we had in the previous report. And you see that, you know, over the last century, ice out is about 5 days earlier than it was at the end of the, well, back in 1865. So another quick indicator of some changes afoot. And the final one is one that we've experienced significantly in this state, which is really the impacts of large precipitation events. And this is, again, a different chart based on the National Climate Assessment. So it's more robust data and showing in the Midwest that since 1958, there's a 37% increase in those largest rainfall event storms. So we're, you know, we're us, the Midwest and New England, feeling this even more, but Midwest experiencing this increase quite a bit more than even like lots of other parts of the nation. Okay, next. And then are there any questions or comments on this?
Kristen.
I just had, all right, so is this replacing the changes in frequency in Minnesota? Because I really like that chart. But well, that won't be in there anymore in this one?
So, yes, maybe? The proposal is to replace it. As it, there's been some new assessment of that chart, and that these trends as presented were not considered significant in terms of statistically in the change. So climate experts, again, you know, did not feel this was strong, robust data. And more we're wanting to rely on the national climate assessments where, you know, there's a lot of, we want the science and the data to be very strong and robust. And so that's where we're tending to rely on it. And we felt like it still painted, gave you the same picture. It's not, basically, you couldn't say, show a significant change for those little 10-year or whatever those 10-year periods were. It's more the longer-term trend where you can see a significant change.
You can tell that I don't relate to this one in the same way that I relate to that one. So, but I understand that you want to use accurate data. It's just I would advocate, you know, I mean, if there's a way to adjust the data so it is. Anyway, that's just feedback.
That yep. No, that's much more useful. Good feedback. Yeah. It's comparable to what we were, you know, talking about before.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
John.
Thanks. Andy, why are you going to the one lake on the ice out date?
It was difficult to update the full lake record with additional lakes. And it was difficult to replicate that analysis, is the short of it. And so, and it was, you know, it's something that could be done, as I understand it, but it hasn't been a priority, for state climatologists to do that. And so it's like, it would take us a lot of work to get additional records in that whole data set for all lakes. So it's, again, a matter of how much more do we slice the data to present it in a way that maybe is more inclusive or more, you know, impactful.
I guess I would question the validity of just one lake as a proxy.
Yeah, so that's a good question. Is very much considered very representative of the trend that was shown in for the whole lake record and is in, you know, essentially central Minnesota. So it's considered a representative, but it is just one lake.
Do we have data on lakes across Minnesota that go back as far as 1865, or is this just one of very few, if any?
What was that? I think it, as I understand it, is one of, there are very few lakes, if any, that go back this far. So that was certainly
one of the reasons.
Yeah. One of the reasons.
Mr. Chair, is there any kind of reporting venue or channel that people can send in ice out dates? I mean, is that one of the ways you gather information? I can't imagine gathering information about ice out dates for all the lakes, and I wondered if there's any tool where, you know, people can send in the ice out dates or any kind of thing like that? It's just an open question.
Right. I mean, yeah. This like lots of our climate records in the state of Minnesota, we have this kind of nationally renowned body of volunteers who collect these records, and they've done it a long time.
I kind of thought that, and, yeah.
Yeah, and more people can do that. You're welcome to do that, and that's how we have this data, frankly, thanks to them.
I think John is more biased because he would like to see data on Ice Lake, but we were in Grand Rapids, but we were afraid that would skew the data too much.
I think Ice Lake is representative.
Thank you.
Eric?
Thanks.
Just a quick general question, and I know there isn't a simple answer, but as you were pulling this data, what format were you finding it in?
It's actually in the format is a very well documented format where I can quickly learn about like the one showing the precipitation events. Again, as one at the federal level, really. All the agencies to really better document and open up their data and integrate it, and that connects our state climatology office. When data is updated, it is updated in an authoritative source. And so when we change something, it changed something in the national database, which means that our data is much more consistent. There is now authoritative climate data sources. So, and it's more visual, it's better documented. So I don't know, my point is, this is an area where the data is quite, it's much more public accessible and more understandable than even when we did this report before. But I don't know if you're quite getting to that.
No. Actually, I misspoke and I apologize. I meant format.
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 Excel versus Access.
Yeah, no, really.
Or SQL or how I'm just kind of curious how.
I mean, we got it in Excel files and so that's how I got it.
Good job creating what you created out of that.
Yeah, thanks.
Other questions or comments?
I'm wondering if Megan
Kate?
Wants.
Yeah,
Megan?
Chair. I wonder.
Are you going to finish it up?
Close this up.
Thank you, Andy and Todd, Lisa, Steve. Happy retirement. Welcome back, Megan.
Thank you. Did you learn
Your
something?
Your people did a good job, by the way.
They yes. did a wonderful job. I learned something every time I listen to them talk about this topic. So I'm learning right along with you guys. So to bring us back full circle, let's talk really briefly about what we can do with this information. All of this information, as you heard, is there's a lot of it and a lot of technical data that may or may not make sense to distribute publicly. It may make more sense to distribute to the legislature in a certain executive summary. It may make more sense to wait until we have an environmental congress to create the environment for this data to go out so we can explain it a little bit better, like we've explained it to you today. So what I want to ask you now is to consider whether or not we should do another version of this document in 2015. Should it be online graphics? Should it be an executive summary, a one-page kind of briefing on what the report card might look like for the resources that we have here in Minnesota, air, land, energy, climate? Should we do a full update of this document? This document is 30-some pages, I think, 28 pages maybe. But also considering the resources that we have, are we adequately resourced, just to bring that back one more time for you? And could we consider offering this as a companion document, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, to an environmental congress, if that is something that the board is considering? So if anybody has questions for me or discussion, and if you want to think about this, I know it's a lot of information to process. Please feel free to drop me or Will an email, and we can get back to you with answers if you have specific questions. But if anybody has anything they'd like to ask right now or offer feedback right now, we'd love to hear it.
Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I think what I'd like to suggest is sort of thinking of the longer term here. I mean, this was a lot of work, and the Congress was a lot of work. I know we're obligated to do annual updates, and I think the web online graphs do that. I'd like to throw out a suggestion that we try to do V2 of this in November of 16. And the reason I would select that date is that we will shortly after that have another new legislature. It will give us time to have something that if there are some policy things that might come out of it, we have the ability to put something together before the next legislative session.
We do have a governor's executive order that directs us to hold the Congress. It also directs us to provide a report card. Mm-hmm. So we'll have to finesse that, maybe, well, if we change.
Mr. Chair, I would envision that. Well, I think the executive order says we will annually update, and maybe it says the report card. I don't think that needs to be a paper document. I don't think that
it says
the executive order says annually a Congress, does it?
It shall be an annual report with renewed priorities, initiatives, and goals, and an updated report card.
Right.
There's some flexibility. Yeah.
And again, this was a huge amount of work, and a Congress is a huge amount of work, and we will never, ever do that every year. be assured of that. So I think we use the Congress, we use the printed document judiciously when it is going to be most beneficial to do that. And I think that is, frankly, right before we get a new legislature.
I just raise it as if, you know, one should always once in a while look back on those executive orders that tell us what we're supposed to be doing and when we're supposed to be doing it.
Useful to do that.
It is, yeah. Kristen and then Kate.
I'm going to wait for Will. Were you going?
No. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to mention to comply with the requirements in the executive order. We do plan to put this presentation on our website as it's being rebuilt now, and we plan to update this on an annual basis online. I think this is a good place and a good time to have the conversation, and we don't need resolution today about how do we envision this requirement playing out going forward and how can we make it most valuable and what's the frequency to do that, what's the audience to do that, and what's the best method of doing that. But we do take seriously the requirements in the executive order and view the website as a way that we can comply on an annual basis regardless of how we kind of recast this report. So.
Kristen?
Given all the tools, I mean, this might be an opportunity. The requirements might be an opportunity to experiment with some of the tools, webinar kind of tools. I mean, what would Environmental Congress look like as a webinar? I mean, are there other ways that we could experiment with this that could fulfill some of these goals and really get, you know, that cycle of public input sustained without doing everything that we did last year? That's the question I have.
Kate?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think having it online makes a lot of sense. And it would be helpful, I think, to have some interpretation as an executive summary form, just because I think not everyone is comfortable looking at data or charts, and it really can make it harder for certain groups to, or certain people to access it. So I think some interpretation, obviously not this entire document interpretation, but some of the highlights or some of the places where the biggest changes were or those sorts of things. And then in terms of missing metrics, this to me is quite retrospective, which I understand that's what a report card is. But I also think as we look at some of these trends with climate specifically and with energy and water, having some idea of what people should be aware of looking forward. So even if it's a simple population graph or a graph of where people in this state are moving, I don't know if we have any, like, a way to track cities that are doing climate planning, whether climate adaptation or climate change plans of some sort, if we could track that, something that shows the action that's happening and some of the potential things to be aware of looking forward, some of the additional pressures. You know, you think, okay, well, our water quality, maybe it's not getting that much better, but if you think about what would have happened with the increased number of people and economic activity, there is a strong story to tell there in terms of not having increased impacts going along with that. So I think something that helps people interpret the pressure, the additional pressure the environment is being put under would be helpful as well. And then ways that we are planning for and preparing for a different kind of future.
Great idea.
John.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, I agree with what Kate just had to say. I think that's the greater challenge, is putting it in context. So I really want to support that. Additionally, I thought, you know, perhaps this could be an assignment for the tech reps to evaluate possible uses of how to engage the citizens and make the best use of the board's time. And perhaps the EQB staff could consult with the tech reps on this matter and put forward a couple of brainstorm as, you know, the folks who are kind of in the trench pulling together all this data. Maybe that's a way that the teasing out where the strengths and weaknesses of different ideas might be presented to the board in the future. So I would encourage the board members, you know, to contribute to the EQB staff, but also we could make use of our technical representatives, those of us that have them, and sort of suggest that that's a good exercise for them to engage in.
The record to reflect that Bob Patton heard that and just snapped to right now. All right. Other questions or comments for Megan or presenters? If not, thank you all very much. Thank you for the hard work that you put in.
Thank you.
I'm going to just jump ship here a little bit, Anna, and I'm going to ask Dan Gilchrist. Dan, I believe, is just going to be here to make a couple of comments, and I want to welcome Dan to the EQB. Dan is the from the University of Minnesota and representing U of M Regional Partnerships.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, citizens, members, and commissioners. I am the Assistant Director of the U of M Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, one of the more difficult named centers at the university, but we are, as you may have learned as you visited the St. Paul campus earlier this year, I believe it was in January, we are tasked with connecting University of Minnesota resources to greater Minnesota communities in the areas of sustainable ag, local food, environmental resources, sustainable tourism, and clean energy. You may be aware of one of our best-known programs, the Clean Energy Resource Teams, a program we were glad to establish several years ago. I'm here to invite members of the board and staff to some climate change convenings related to climate change mitigation that the partnerships will be holding over the next year. And this is courtesy of the MPCA Environmental Assistance Grant Program. And we'll be doing five of those to inform Minnesotans of the consequences of climate change and to learn what innovations and strategies they're considering and deploying at the household, farmstead, and community level. To add a little bit of star power, at least what we consider star power at the university, Mark Seeley, the Extension meteorologist, will be joining us for many of these convenings. We are also pleased to be partnering with the Will Steger Foundation, who have a grant to do similar but distinctly different convenings all across the state on climate change adaptation and climate change knowledge. So we're working closely with them. And thanks to Dr. Anna Henderson, we're also tracking the CZO process and want to make sure that the good information that's coming out of that is distributed and is shared at these convenings. And we will be, courtesy of the Steger Foundation and I believe the McKnight Foundation, distributing the earlier report on climate change that the EQB published. So just wanted to invite EQB commissioners and citizen members to join us in Greater Minnesota at those five convenings. We will be scheduling them. I'll keep commission staff the board staff here apprised of when those are scheduled. We have one scheduled in Southwest Minnesota in Lamberton for early February. We don't quite have a date yet. And one in Northwest for May, and we don't quite have dates on those. So we are still working on that, but we also want to extend a special invitation to EQB and interagency staff to attend those and to work with us on these convenings, because I think they are going to be very interesting. And we're working with the Steger Foundation very closely to make sure that there's a lot of work that happens on the ground beforehand, so that we are adequately and, we're bringing relevant information to these communities. So that's my invitation to you, and we hope to see you at our climate change convenings next year.
Thank you very much, Dan. Any questions for Dan? Not. I know that the last time you were here, you didn't get a chance to speak. I apologize for that.
No, that was my fault. I should have stood up and yelled at you, Commissioner.
Yeah, right. These guys, too.
I have a quick question.
Sure.
Are each of the convenings going to be kind of the same agenda, or so are that kind of repetitive but getting feedback?
There is going to be,
or is it
there's going to be a format, and we are right now it looks like the best format that we can find is to have two nights, and one night the Steger Foundation will talk about in general climate change adaptation issues, and they have a specific agenda. They'll also be reaching out to educators in the area to make sure that there's, you know, adequate curriculum and regionally specific weather information. And ours, you know, like I said, is more, our convenings are more focused on these sort of adaptations and mitigations that folks are already taking to these measures that they're taking to deal with some of the weather and climate conditions that you saw reflected in the last presentation.
All right. Thank you very much. And to Mark Seeley, absolutely. If Mark Seeley shows up, I'll be there.
All right. And you earlier had a question about acres and conservation, and boy, am I not an expert in that. But I'm housed close to those folks, but right. That doesn't rub off on me very much. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Dan.
So if John. Commissioner Fredrickson attends, would that add star power or detract? I'm just curious,
trash.
Dan, on your take on that.
To be sure. And I know that Commissioner Stein, that we'll have a lot more Twitter followers if you actually
attend.
You're
there. Yourself,
yeah. So.
Good call.
Thank you very much, Dan. All right. Anna, CCO. Not WCCO, but CCO. Anna Henderson, Dr. Anna Henderson.
Well, I grew up in Rochester where the post bulletin only calls physicians doctors, so I revel in calling PhDs.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Chair and members of the board, my name is Anna Henderson. I'm EQB staff, and I'm going to be giving you an update on the CZO work and also putting some of this work into context. And I appreciate Dan's comments. I think they set us up well for this.
Thank you, Beth.
So the goal of the CZO work is to identify strategies that bend the curve. So what you're looking at here are Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions, the inventoried ones, and the projected ones. So we're going from 1990 to 2030. Does this have a little dot? Yeah. No.
It won't show up on the screen.
It shows up everywhere but the screen.
You got to use the mouse if you really want to.
Okay. So I just want to point out that these green dotted lines show the next generation goals. So this is a 2015 goal. The 2025 goal, which is 30% reductions below 2005 levels, and the next goal is 2050. So that interim 2030 goal, which is the end date of the scope of the CZO work, is a linear extrapolation between 2025 and 2050. It's not a benchmark that's in the statute. I just wanted to caveat that because there are different rates that could happen. When we look at our business as usual projections and that interim 2030 goal, what we're missing is about a reduction of about 50 million metric tons a year. So that's the difference that we would want to make up to bend the curve to meet the Next Generation Act. And these blue lines that I have here, this is representing what we're doing in CZO. So it's looking at specific strategies and seeing how much they get us below business as usual in terms of emissions. We've also been thinking a lot about economic development and policies that have some kind of economic potential and what that looks like. And what I'm showing you here, these are both graphs that go from 1997 to 2011, and the blue line is the greenhouse gas emissions. And on the left side, we're looking at gross state product, and on the right, we're looking at population. And in both, we see that we're growing our state in terms of population and in terms of economic development, and that that is not connected to our greenhouse gas emissions, but that those have diverged. We think there's a lot of economic potential, and this is in part that we have no fossil fuels in Minnesota. We export billions of dollars every year. If we generate more in-state renewables, that represents jobs that are in Minnesota and money that's staying in our economy. There have recently also been transportation issues getting propane and coal to Minnesota, and those raise issues of reliability and also price volatility that have an impact on our communities and businesses. Also, development of the state renewable energy diversifies our energy, which makes us more resilient to changes that are beyond our control. Just an overview of the project, we're looking across economic sectors of Minnesota at energy supply, demand-side management in residential, commercial, institutional, and industrial sector, transportation and land use, agriculture, forestry, which also includes grasslands and wetlands, and waste management. And within each of these sectors, we have a range of different strategies that we have been looking at. The overall workflow is that we are looking at, for each strategy, the greenhouse gas emissions reductions, we're analyzing the costs and savings. That's the microeconomic analysis that we have been currently doing and that Tom, the CEO of the consulting group, presented to you on. The next stage is the macroeconomic part. We don't think it'll take as long. And that's looking at regional economic modeling of secondary economic impacts like jobs. Stakeholder involvement has been a very big part of this process. We really kicked off the process last March with an EQB subcommittee meeting where we had a roundtable here with about 65 people discussing what strategies we should analyze. More recently, we've started having sector-specific technical webinars. These are held by the analyst from CCS who's been doing the work. They are open and publicly posted. Anybody can participate and ask questions. And after those webinars, we post them onto the CZO website, which is hosted by Environmental Initiatives, so that anybody can go and look at them and have access to them. The first two of those that we've had, we had about 65 participants for each one. We're also holding in-person stakeholder meetings to discuss how we take these strategies and develop them into programs and what that would look like. And these meetings have about, so far we've had about 100 people at each, and we've broken them down into small roundtable discussions so that everybody has a chance to talk. We have a note taker and a facilitator at each roundtable. And Environmental Initiatives is taking all of the notes from those meetings, and they are going to process them. This is a picture from Monday morning at one of these meetings. You can see the tables. This is at the end of the meeting when the groups were presenting back to each other what they thought the key findings and points were. The final products that we expect to have are from the Center for Climate Strategies, a technical report. From Environmental Initiatives, a report on the stakeholder meetings focused on implementation, and then the EQB will be doing an executive summary to put these two sides together and really give the key highlights for people who aren't going to be interested in spending time going through a long technical report. The results are still preliminary. There are still models that are being built and worked on, and some of the assumptions that are being looked at and considered through some sensitivity analysis. But from what we have seen so far, there are many strategies that have an overall net savings for society. So that means that over the 15-year study period, we see a savings. And there might be an upfront capital cost to doing those and other barriers like that. But overall, these look like they offer opportunities for Minnesota. So it's not climate action just with a price tag, but even climate action with overall economic benefits. In terms of reaching the next generation goals at 50 million metric ton annual reduction, our two sectors that have the biggest impacts from what we've seen in terms of reductions are energy supply and the demand side management. And each of those have about 20 million metric ton reductions in 2030. So when you put everything together, it looks like we get close to that goal. We did not ask the consultants to reach that goal. We didn't say, whatever you do, take these strategies and end up here. We said, here are these strategies, and we want to see where you think this gets us to. Just wanted to put in context what a million metric tons of CO2 equivalent looks like. So these are some numbers from the EPA. So just 1 million metric tons is the equivalent of heating 90,000 homes for a year, or the annual emissions from 200,000 cars, or consuming about 2 billion barrels of oil. I want to spend a little bit of time on the strategy that had the biggest impact, just to give you a sense of what went into all of these analyses, and also to give you an understanding of this policy that has the biggest impact. So this is increasing the state's renewable energy standard to 40 or 50%. And to start, I just wanted to provide perspective that we indeed have ample renewable energy potential in the state. So this is a reasonable strategy to look at. And what I'm showing here is renewable resources, biomass, different types of PV that are summarized in the all PV line, wind and small hydro. And the first column is showing the existing capacity in Minnesota in megawatts. And the second column is showing calculations done by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, showing what they think the potential is in Minnesota. And just to put those into context for what do we need in Minnesota to meet our demand, in 2011, during peak summer demand, we needed about 17,000 megawatts of energy. So when we look at our renewable energy potential, it's orders of magnitude beyond that. And of course, there are considerations for that potential in terms of transmission lines and reliability that make it not just a really simple calculation of getting to these. So what we were doing with this policy is we assume in our business as usual that we're meeting the 28.5% renewable energy standard that we have in the Next Generation Energy Act. And so what we're looking at is just the incremental changes beyond that to 40 or 50%. If this was a policy the state was to take on, it probably wouldn't have specific numbers for each type of renewable energy. But to model it, we had to get really specific. So this is something in each of the policies that when you model it, we had to give specific numbers so they have something to go on. So in this case, I made a little table just to illustrate it, that for both scenarios, it's about 30% wind and about 3% biomass, CHP, and small hydro. And the big difference between them is the amount of solar. So the 50% meets that 10% solar goal that the state has. Every policy required making assumptions so that we could use specific numbers. And in this case, one of the really big assumptions we had to make is what type of energy is each renewable energy source displacing? So if you increase wind, what are you displacing that you would otherwise have been using? And because wind predominantly generates electricity in off-peak hours, we made the assumption that it is displacing coal. And solar is generated during the daytime, during peak hours, and we made the assumption that it is displacing natural gas. Biomass isn't time-dependent, and for that, we made an assumption of displacing a mix of natural gas and coal. That's about 2080. Yes?
Yeah, a question. Just sorry to get in the weeds here, but I would presume wind was more abundant during the day than at night. Is it not?
Lise knows. Lise is actually the expert who's been working on this.
Welcome again, Lise. Want to introduce yourself.
Thank you. Lise, Department of Commerce, and it's been a team effort for sure. But wind certainly does have an accredited capacity factor, which kind of coincides with our load during the day of about 14%. but primarily wind blows at night in Minnesota. In other areas close to coastal regions, it may blow more during the day, but in our continental area, it's primarily a nighttime resource.
That's a surprise to me, having farmed for most of my life. The daytime hours were the toughest time for spraying crops because of wind drift. And if you could go out in the evening, it always worked much better.
And they're definitely, you know.
So I've been wrong for all those years.
you haven't been wrong. It depends where you're farming.
10 feet above the air. Every
day. Yeah. Yes. So it's blowing up above, right?
Well, it might be. It might be blowing, all the time. But it depends on how.
It just didn't get down to
blowing.
The ground in the yeah. After the sun goes down.
We make a lot of our energy during those storms or during those really high wind. October and the shoulder months, spring and October, are the highest.
Thanks for straightening me out.
Anytime.
Mr. Chairman.
Not at night.
Oh, let's drive a truck right now. Let's get the truck in this alley. Mr. Chairman, I understand the wind is always blowing in Murdoch.
It is. It totally is, yeah.
Or the hot air.
The hot air. Okay, I asked for that, I know. Okay, please.
So these are the preliminary results from these two scenarios.
I don't like these people.
And what we're showing is those 2030 annual emissions reductions are around 10 and 16 million metric tons for the 40 and 50% scenarios. If you look cumulatively over the 15-year period, you're looking at 90 and 115 million. There's a price tag for both of these. So a lot of the policies have a savings. These are ones that have a cost, and it's about $1 billion. And one of the metrics that CCS uses is this cost-effective term, which is a ratio of how much it costs per a ton of CO2 that you're reducing. And so that's one way to try to compare different policies, and you can see that here. If you have more questions about this, Lisa's still up here, so you're welcome to ask her.
No way. Questions? Thanks, Anna.
I wanted to put this work into a little bit of a broader context and also connect it back to the MCAG process that we did. So researchers from the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute looked at state climate plans. This was published in 2011, so it's not the most up-to-date, but it is very comprehensive. And what we're looking at is a map of the United States. All the shaded states have some sort of state climate action plan. The darker ones were done by the Center for Climate Strategies, the consultants we worked with in 2008 and who we're working with now. And this paper looked at those 10 states to see when you get to different states, are there different policies that have big impacts, or are there a set of policies that are kind of universal that you're getting the biggest impact for? And what they found was that 70% of the reductions came from the top 5 strategies for all of those states, and 90% of the reductions came from the top 10 strategies. And so those top strategies in order are building efficiency, renewable energy, what they categorize as forestry and soils, which is a bucket of a lot of things. So it's reforestation, it's low-till farming, and it's conservation of land. Number 4 is efficient vehicles, and number 5 is reduced vehicle use. 6 through 10, which they just kind of lump into one color, are efficient power plants, which is another kind of bucket of combined heat and power, efficient processes, going from coal to natural gas. 7 is biofuels, 8 is waste management, 9 is biomass for electricity, and 10 is nuclear power plants, which were only looked at in a small fraction, but they had a large impact, so they included them here. And the big finding is just the same strategies have the biggest impacts, but different ratios made sense for different states. I also just wanted to give a little bit of context about how this all fits in with ongoing efforts that are outside of the executive branch of state government. So there's the regional indicators work that Rick Carter has been leading at LHB that provides per capita data for cities on energy consumption and water consumption. So that's a much more local focus. And we've been talking a lot about what we can learn from him and what he can learn from us. the work that Dan Gilchrist introduced, we're really excited that they're going to be distributing our publication, and we hope to be working with them and to disseminate some of the results from CZO through the work that they're doing. The Legislative Energy Commission is leading this energy future framework that also involves Department of Commerce and Lease is the key person there on that, and they are looking at how much clean energy is possible in Minnesota and how fast can we get there. The Green Step Cities and CERTs are supporting local governments and citizen action, and we've also been talking to them a lot about how we can support their work and how these findings might help them. And the National Renewable Energy Lab and the federal government have efforts to support state and local clean energy development through research, funding, and reports. And we have some key contacts in the federal government who are talking to us and trying to help give us some technical support. And overall, I think it just shows that there's an appetite for the type of work that we are producing, and we're really happy to be able to meet that. I just, as an example, wanted to show one of these efforts. This is output from the regional indicators data, and it is per capita CO2 emissions from 2012. To the far left are standalone cities, so places like Rochester and Minneapolis. Then there are inner ring suburbs, places like Richfield and Edina, and then the outer ring suburbs like White Bear Lake and Lake Elmo. And we're looking at the energy, the vehicle miles traveled just within that city. It's not going to other places from that city. Their waste, air travel, and wastewater. And this is a different scale of information, but it's really helpful for thinking about what types of action can have impacts on our greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Questions, Charlie?
You know, in terms of the goals, I mean, I know that you're saying we get close by 2030. How close is close? And then two, as this informs policy, I'm of course thinking for transportation, that's a big chunk. And I'm meeting with our administration, the governor's office, and they're thinking, and just knowing them, he's not like, let's make progress toward the goal. He says, let's make the goal, or at least propose a solution, because it'll get watered down from there. So how does this inform, you know, kind of what we're doing? I mean, it's a general question for us as a board.
I just want to caveat what I've said so that you don't come away with the wrong understanding. We looked at a range of strategies across the economy, and when you add those all up, they look like they just about meet the goal, or they might exceed it a little bit. But that would mean we would have to do every single one of those strategies to the full extent. And I can't speak to whether that in and of itself is possible.
Yeah, I mean, that was my reaction. And I kind of think it shouldn't be an interesting thing to look at. Wow, that's a cool study. And then we're going to wander off and do our normal business. I mean, I know in the, like, vehicle miles traveled, absolutely, they're getting flat. They might even go down. And as cars turn over, they're getting more clean. They're getting cleaner. So that just might happen. But on the other hand, we're getting tremendous increases in freight traffic that's not on that chart. It happens after 2010. And we're getting a tremendous amount of freight rail, which, as I understand it, those big diesel engines don't have the little filters. I have to check with John. But, I mean, those are...
You are correct.
They're nasty, you know, and we're getting a lot of them. So I'm actually kind of thinking, you know, it's actually getting worse. And
yes,
what can we do? Because if we're going to try to bend the curve toward 2030, I don't see a path, you know, in terms of a practical, this is a really helpful tool, but we better get going if it really is, you know, going to be make a difference.
Kit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Zelli. I would just say yes to everything you just said. but can I, and I know that we talked about this last time, but it's something I just can't remember. Is the Clean Power Plan at the federal level included in this? My guess is it being modeled? Because it wasn't included in business as usual because it's not law yet. So just could you explain how the Clean Power Plan at the federal level is treated in this work?
So the Clean Power Plan is in draft form still, and there are a number of issues that we don't have clarity on. Mm-hmm. And so to model it poses a lot of challenges since we don't have clarity on what the parameters are and what the final rule is going to be. And the way that we've thought about it is that there are a number of logical questions that we expect to be asked about how this work relates to and informs the Clean Power Plan, and that we want to be able to try to answer those as best as possible. And one of the kind of main strategy that we've thought about is that there are packages of policies that people will think about together, like increasing the renewable energy standard and the energy efficiency standard. And so we want to be able to talk about how those two policies specifically interact together. So we're trying to work with the consultants to look at packages of policies that we think are relevant to the conversation on 111D, while we are unable to anticipate exactly what that final rule is going to be.
John?
Mr. Chair, I agree with everything you just said. However, if the rule were to come out even close to its current form, let's just start with an assumption on that, and we analyze against what are, I think, some reasonable interpretations of the questions, of the answers to the questions that we asked the EPA in 111D, the marginal benefit that Minnesota would see from trying to stretch toward those goals for 111D would not be a dramatically increased level of greenhouse gas emission reductions because of our state energy goals already set us on that course. So we're not likely to see a dramatic bump in an expectation. It will be increase our expectation, but I don't think it's likely to contribute dramatically to an increase in greenhouse gas emission reductions.
Anna, we did have a conversation regarding the lack of respect that ethanol production consumption has in this state. We had a conversation with folks that had a concern about that, and they felt that, at least for the board's understanding, they felt that they were sort of disrespected in this whole process and that their contribution to greenhouse gas reduction was just rolled up in another metric, and we're concerned about that. Have you thought any more about that discussion we've had?
Their questions weren't specific to what we had done here, and some of their concerns were about the lack of discussing biofuels in webinars on electricity generation and other areas. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure exactly how to address their questions, but I can say that we looked at two policies that are nested together on that with the goal of meeting the state's goals for biofuels. And so some portion of that is from ethanol, and then nested into that is advanced biofuels. And we were not doing a full life cycle analysis of biofuels like you see coming out of national labs. And so one of the concerns raised was whether or not we use the GREET model, which is part of getting at the indirect land use effects of biofuels. But that is really beyond the scope of the work that we did. We're using numbers that other people have studied to inform that. And the Department of Agriculture worked really hard with the consultants on modeling the biofuel policy, and they felt very comfortable with where we landed and with the data and assumptions. And so I put my faith in them, and I
think put that, your faith in the Department of Agriculture.
So I think that we have results that are interesting to talk about, and that there's an infinite number of sensitivities that you could do to say, well, if we change this lever, how much of a difference could we get here? And if we generate that kind of conversation on biofuels, I think that would be really successful.
Thank you. Other questions? Kristen?
Mr. Chair, I'm really glad to see that last slide that talks about all the partners outside of this immediate piece, and that there is, since we've released this climate change report and tried to engage the whole citizenry in this work, I'm really hoping to continue to strongly build from both ends, the regulatory utility and the local government, and also I know it's not covered a lot in this, but I'm interested in the additional investment that distributed generation brings to the pot. You know, it's not the same kind of utility investment. So so that's a piece that I'm really interested in seeing how it might be involved in this. And to Kate's point earlier, I don't know what the vehicle for this is, but I think it could be a very powerful little tool to do what we can to gather information about what goals each of the cities have. I know it's really complex because they're all doing different international or state goals. But as an ongoing tool for engagement, I think it would be really helpful to know what their goals are, the different cities across the state.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair.
John.
This question isn't necessarily directed at you, Anna, maybe more to the EQB. But we see the CZO is very, very valuable in presenting us with some tools and some policy options that can help us bridge the gap that we see in the future. And as you indicated, you know, if everything was instituted, it might be in that area, but probably not. I mean, we're probably not going to get all those policies instituted. So that means we've still got a gap out there. And my question is, and it relates to all these things we've been talking about, how active a role does the EQB play in bridging that gap? Where do we belong there? We've taken this first step with CZO. So, just a question.
Anyone? John?
Well, Will asked the question earlier when he was presenting his work plan. And I do think we have to consider the investment that the board has made in this information from it strikes me as valuable information. It paints the picture of the future with I think what most people will agree is reliable information, and we shouldn't our duty, I think, as a board to take action to promote it, not to simply admire it. Mm-hmm. So that in response to your question, John, I think we need to have at the end of the dialogue with the stakeholders and the reports coming together from the staff, what Anna described, that's when we really need to ask that question, which is now that we have heard all of this, what's our next set of steps? But I would be very adamant, and forewarn you, that I think we need to act on it. We can't just admire it.
Other comments? Eric?
I would agree, Commissioner Stein, to keep moving forward with this. I mean, if we're coming up with policy recommendations, let's get this in the hands of people who make policy, you know, as a decision-making tool. One question I did have as far as how dynamic is this model, and I guess this comes down to future plans, or do we plan to check in 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, to see how we're doing, and are the metrics that we set out, well, I expect they're measurable, so we can find out how it's going. And then I guess add on to my question on how dynamic the model is. As incentives expire, new incentives are generated, technologies change, can this, if we're going to use it as a tool moving forward to measure, can it be tweaked to reflect those changes?
Anna.
Thank you. And Will, you're welcome to jump in at any point, too. This is something that we think a lot about, where right now we have consultants who are doing the work and they're giving us a snapshot in time. And I know that from 2008 till now, there are some policies that we're looking at that people weren't thinking about then as reasonable. So, for example, electric vehicles weren't looked at 2008, but we're looking at them right now. And we have been asking ourselves whether we should be building in-house capability to be doing this type of work on an ongoing basis, so that if we have the product from the consultants and could continue to tweak it and look at different sensitivities and different assumptions, if that's useful, and also, is it should that all be geared at the state level action, or should we be doing that to support local units of government type action? And so we've really been doing some soul searching on that, and the concept of the climate technical assistance team really incorporates that spirit of doing something along those lines. And so I don't know if I'm allowed to ask you guys questions, but I think
you can ask them, but you're not required to answer.
but identifying what Commissioner Zelli started with, wanting to know what actions we're going to take to see these things through, and having some direction from the board as to what you think are the most meaningful steps and the appropriate role of the EQB in doing that would be most welcome.
Will.
And I can chime in a little bit. I mean, there are a couple of things to also to think about, you know, as we go forward, and what is the role of the board? Where do we add value, and where do we hand things off back to the agencies and other audiences? And I think our role is really about is trying to coordinate and add some accountability to the discussion. But we can engage the public through this forum. But ultimately, it's the agencies who have jurisdictions over different pieces that can really pick up the baton for different components of this and move forward. And I do know for a fact some agencies are doing that on different components of this through their normal policy and budget development process with the governor's office and hopefully with the legislature afterwards. And, there are a lot of policies that I think we're learning about through this that aren't ready for prime time, and that's why we're having these stakeholder conversations. We really hope, and many of you have willingly, are participating in these, because we do need to have that next conversation, which is how do we really turn this into action. And we encourage everyone to participate in that. But I mean, the one thing as we think about, and from a resource perspective, there was a lot of interagency participation in this. And I think we don't, we don't foresee that such a high level being sustainable. And, there was also a lot of foundation support, and that's not something we can plan around either. And so the things that what we really are trying to do, and part of the reason for our seeking some dollars from the legislature, is really to try and institutionalize this and build it so we can develop some of the capacity in-house and not have to rely on external consultants. And but we also don't want to be in the position where we have to ramp down some of this work to go and do some of our other projects that were required through statute. So there's a challenging prioritization task that we have ahead of us. And so thank you for really wrestling with this. We appreciate it.
Charlie.
Well, and I just, since I kind of brought it up, I think that we're not going to figure this out in negative 4 minutes, but we do have to kind of have it on the agenda about how, since we now have data and we have started something, how do we continue to keep the spotlight on it and frame it? I think there is great value in our kind of collectively kind of saying this is a shared issue to which a lot of different agencies have a role, and it will help, I think, us not just think about it, but to measure that against the overall goal.
Mr. Chair, if I could delay us just one or two more minutes. I think that we shouldn't underestimate what a powerful shift in narrative this work on the energy, environment, and economy is, and that the way in which the material is presented, some of the new assumptions that are given about the relationship between these things. I've been listening to this conversation for 20 years, and this is really a breakthrough kind of narrative. And so I would like to see one of the things that the board does is to keep a spotlight on that narrative and keep moving it forward in different venues, because it's a completely different story than we've been living with and negotiating around, at least in my experience, at the legislature and energy politics. So I just want to say what a huge piece I think that is of the work that's been done, and that I hope we can carry that forward effectively.
Well, I agree, and thanks to the work that Bob did in the first couple of years, and thanks to the work that Will is doing now and the ramping and amping up of the staff, I think we've come a really long, long way. We are, in fact, sort of multifunctional in that we're part state planning, we're part environmental review, we're part of a whole lot of things, and I think it's our job to look at options, look at priorities, and then showcase them, and I think CCO work is a classic example of that. Now, I am going to borrow from a comment I heard one of the presenters make at the summit, in the Pheasant Summit, who said that he managed to compress 4 years of college into five. We've managed to compress 2 hours worth of work into 3 hours and 5 minutes. So I think it is probably time to call for a motion to adjourn.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
There is a motion. There is a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you, both of you, Anna, for your great work, and Lise for your supporting role in this process.
Take all you want.
Oh, no. I mean, there's just rich couple
of things. Oh, okay. I just stumbled in with...